Meeting of Parliament, Monday the 17th of May 2021. Order of proceedings, suspension of standing orders, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with a government statement.
Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, may I start my intervention this afternoon wishing all the best to our Jewish community on the festival Shavuot, which is the festival of the harvest and the law. I'm grateful to the Honourable Lady for joining us today, despite it being her festival, although she won't be an active participant in the proceedings. She has my apology that we have to meet today to get through the business of the House in the third week of the month. Mr. Speaker, this year our Jewish community is able to celebrate as our Muslim community did with Eid, with a much more normal situation. We celebrate in that way together, not just the religious festival, but also the closer normality that we all crave, and in respect of which Gibraltar is the envy of the world, thanks to the work of so many. Mr. Speaker, I'm also happy to confirm the arrival last night of more vaccines in Gibraltar, after huge efforts by colleagues in the FCDO and the convent in Gibraltar, after myriad logistical challenges were getting in their way of their transit to Gibraltar. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the success of the vaccination program has been such that yesterday we saw the first day of zero cases across the board in Gibraltar since July last year. We will have more cases in future, no doubt, but this is an important milestone for Gibraltar. Today, Mr. Speaker, we have seen the first arrivals from the United Kingdom of flights which will benefit from Gibraltar being on the UK's green list for air travel. We are delighted at the advent of this moment. Air travel between the United Kingdom and Gibraltar is not just about tourism. Given our unbreakable and almost filial link with the UK, travel between us is about families reuniting. It's about the social aspects of our relationship, about business and trade, and also about tourism. The high level of vaccination in the United Kingdom and the complete adult vaccination in Gibraltar also made the re-establishment of an open-air corridor very safe. For that reason, we have hoped and advertised that arrivals from the UK would not require testing on arrival in Gibraltar. Alas, Mr. Speaker, this morning, the government has had to take the tough decision to continue testing all arrivals from the United Kingdom. We said before that we would not require a PCR test for those arriving from the UK, and that will still be the case. The testing required will be a lateral flow test on arrival. But the fact is that after many months of good news, falling COVID cases and the successful vaccination campaign in any large, the most successful vaccination campaign in any large nation in the world, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has alerted the public to the onset of infections of what is referred to as the Indian variant in the UK. There was even comment of the potential for England's full relaxation of rules in June to be in jeopardy because of the potential of greater pressure on the NHS if the variant takes hold. This thorn in the plans is one of the variants of coronavirus that has emerged from India, which is referred to as B16172. For the first time this weekend, the Prime Minister has referred to the advice from scientists advising the UK government that they are confident that it does spread more easily than other variants. This morning, I met with the GHA's consultant microbiologist, Nick Cortez, to discuss these issues, as he has also raised these concerns directly with us yesterday. Also with me were the Deputy Chief Minister, the Minister for Tourism and Transport, and the Ministers for Health and Public Health, and our magnificent Civil Contingencies Coordinator. Mr. Speaker, from the advice we received from Dr. Cortez, it is clear that the expectation is that the variant will become more prevalent than the so-called Kent variant. The UK is clearly, therefore, in a race between the virus and the vaccine. The much-awaited easing of restrictions in the UK today, coupled with a more transmissible variant, will mean that the virus will move even faster. There is still no clarity about exactly how much faster the B16172 variant spreads. The UK government's scientific advisory group for emergencies says there is a realistic possibility it could spread 50% faster. There are some higher estimates of 60% greater speed of infection from India itself. Anything that is more than 40% more transmissible than the Kent variant could once again unleash issues of resurgence of hospitalizations if the variant is resistant to vaccines. For us, it is more about potential resistance to the Pfizer vaccine in particular, as the vast majority of our population have had that inoculation. There is no clear science on that yet. Dr. Cortez has today referred us to anecdotal evidence of two cases of hospitalization in the United States, where the Center for Disease Control reports the cases appear to have had full Pfizer inoculations. One case appears to have been reported in the United Kingdom of a post-vaccination hospitalization with the Indian variant. But the data is not yet reliable, and the science is not yet there. We therefore need to be cautious in our approach and remain vigilant in the regime we have in place for arrivals at Gibraltar Airport. It is in that context, Mr. Speaker, that the government has today acted in keeping with the advice we have received from Dr. Cortez. Given the concerns expressed by the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom and the advice we have received from Dr. Cortez, the decision was taken by a ministerial subcommittee to continue testing arrivals with a quick lateral flow test. This decision was later ratified by the full cabinet at this morning's session. We took the decision to vary the cabinet decision in the committee to ensure that we were able to give effect to it by 11 a.m. today upon the arrival of the first British Airways flight. The cabinet fully agreed with our decision based on the logical consideration of the advice received. The ratification was therefore by unanimous consensus. Mr. Speaker, the test that will be required, as I've said, will be an instant lateral flow test. Our position remains that no PCR test will be required on arrival. There will be no charge to the arriving traveller. This will continue whilst more information on the effect of the Indian variant is assessed. The application of the precautionary principle must prevail, Mr. Speaker, whilst we will continue to be as welcoming of our kith and kin from the United Kingdom. Thank you.
The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Honourable Member's statement. And indeed, on this side of the House, at least speaking for myself and the members I represent, we, of course, in the context of medical and public health advice that the Chief Minister has indicated, we welcome the decision taken. Indeed, there had been already some discussion in Gibraltar about the difference between what had been assumed was the position hitherto after the Chief Minister's intervention on Sky News that people arriving from the UK would not be tested, but that it was clear from the UK's own measures on the green lighting of different territories that was not the case for anyone going over to the UK. And so you had that dichotomy that people who were flying to the UK from Gibraltar would be tested, but that perhaps people flying from the UK to Gibraltar would not be. That's been clarified today and for the reasons that the Chief Minister has given. I have some questions, and perhaps the Honourable Member would be able to clarify for me. The Honourable Member talks about that the test will be a lateral flow test and as opposed to a PCR test. And there will be people listening to this debate who will not understand the difference. Perhaps the Honourable Member can explain why the medical advice is that it should be a lateral flow test and not a PCR test. Am I right in understanding what he has just said, which is that the lateral flow test will be applied on arrival in Gibraltar, or is it that they do a lateral flow test before departing the UK? So, because obviously that would be a difference. Presumably, if they are positive, they would not board. If they're tested on arrival, they'll have to go into self-isolation and ruin the 7 days package tour in the Caleta Palace. But clearly, that would have to be the effect of it. Does the Chief Minister, when he says that it will be at no cost to the passenger, is there a cost for the supply of the lateral flow, or is it that the government is supplying the testing on lateral flow, or is it that a third party is supplying the lateral flow system test? If so, if there is a cost to the government, is there an estimate, and who is burdened with that cost? And in terms of the and then two more questions arising generally from the statement, and also perhaps it would be good for the Chief Minister to clarify, is the government intending to introduce, I assume, regulations under the civil contingencies rules providing for these matters, and is there a requirement for someone to be vaccinated for them to fly to Gibraltar under this sort of reciprocal green lighting system? And does the Chief Minister, in his discussions with the medical professionals that he's indicated today, I know he's given some indication of vaccine effectiveness, and I believe he said that the jury's out on the issue, words to that effect, without using that phrase. But is there anything more that he can share with us on that, or is it that, because I have also seen speculation the other way, that I've seen speculation that the COVID Pfizer vaccine is resistant to the Indian variant. So is it that because we are in a period of uncertainty, the measures are being taken because it's uncertain, but rather it's being taken because there's some kind of school of thought that there might be an issue in respect of the Indian variant? So I'd be grateful if the Honourable Member can clarify those issues.
The Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know how much of my statement the Honourable Gentleman missed. I think that some of what he asks I dealt with before he arrived. But you know, I'm grateful that the House is not divided on this issue, and that we both sides seem to be in agreement as to the importance of taking this position. The Honourable Gentleman started his intervention by saying that he had noted that there had been discussion in Gibraltar about the fact that there was going to be a different regime to access Gibraltar than there would be to access the United Kingdom. In other words, on return to the United Kingdom from Gibraltar, as indeed on return to the United Kingdom from every other country in the world, an arriving person would be required to have a PCR test. I believe it's within 72 hours of arrival and shown that is negative, whilst that would not have been the case in the context of arrivals to Gibraltar. Well, Mr. Speaker, that is something that has been known for some time. I mean, we made the announcement that you wouldn't require a PCR test to come to Gibraltar some 2 to 3 weeks ago. And that is not an issue that has been raised at all with the government in the past by honourable members. I know that they are trigger happy and they raise issues at a moment's notice when they think it's appropriate. So the fact that they haven't raised that in the past, I will assume, is a demonstration that they realise that it was not something that would have been necessary or expedient. And Mr. Speaker, in answering the other point that members have raised, I think I demonstrate the fact that it would be neither necessary or expedient, as I do really recommend an expectorant, Mr. Speaker, when it gets to that level. Mr. Speaker, because as I've said publicly before, the fact is that we have an open border, as we want to have and we have fought to have, with the European continent and the Schengen states, and we are seeing already almost 15,000 people come through that frontier every day, not all of whom, of course, are vaccinated cross-frontier workers. And we hope we will see more people arriving through that frontier, whilst at the airport, until now, we may have seen 80 or 200 people a day. And with the Green Corridor, with the additional flights, more flights than we've ever had before, to more destinations than we've ever had before, thanks to the magnificent work being done by the Minister for Tourism, we might have just shy of 500 or 800 arrivals today. So really, one has to ask oneself, epidemiologically and politically, whether if you have an open frontier with the European continent and you've got 15,000 people at least coming through every day and you're not testing there, whether it makes epidemiological or political sense to require testing on arrivals from the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, the integrationists in the House would obviously have a view. And that view, Mr. Speaker, would necessarily suggest that the political aspects of this require a careful consideration. The epidemiological aspects, I think, would trump any political consideration. But they have not been relevant, Mr. Speaker, because the advice we had when you put it in the balance was clearly pointing you towards realizing that you were receiving from the United Kingdom from a general population which has already seen 60% of its adults receive at least a first dose versus a European continent where the first doses to all adults are at best in the 20%. So the risk analysis there would point towards not doing the testing at the airport. Mr. Speaker, what has happened in the past 24 to 48 hours is that the British Prime Minister has received advice, which he has immediately shared, about the growth of the Indian variant in the United Kingdom, which shows that the exponential growth is faster than the Kent variant. And, Mr. Speaker, there is one distinguishing factor that we must bear in mind in the context of the United Kingdom, and it's that the ability to detect the Indian variant seems to be more readily available in the United Kingdom. Indeed, I can share with the House today that we've now done all our testing and verification, and we will now be able to verify genomically ourselves what virus we find in Gibraltar. So the United Kingdom can do it, Gibraltar can do it, we'll be able to do it now in a space of 72 to 96 hours. In the European Union, there is the ability to do that, but that ability is not as well spread out through the whole of the Union. But the European Union has not had flights from India for some time, whilst the United Kingdom had an open air border with India, subject to quarantining and testing, etc., for a little longer. And so we do face now, and we have faced in the last 48 hours, the advice that actually, epidemiologically, you now have the issue that the Indian variant is more likely to come from the United Kingdom than from the European continent. That's the reason why we've introduced the need to test. Of course, when I say introduce the need to test, Mr. Speaker, in answering another one of the Honourable Gentleman's question, all we are going to do is roll over the regime as it was last night when the airport closed. So this morning, the airport was not going to require a test on arrival. Yesterday, it required a test on arrival, or alternatively, a negative PCR within 72 hours of arrival, which an individual is always able to do. What we're going to do, therefore, Mr. Speaker, is continue the regime at the airport as it was last night. And in doing so, what we'll be offering will be the lateral flow tests, which are the tests that we've been offering at the airport. There is a difference between a lateral flow test and a PCR test. Honourable members will know that depending on the PCR test, it can be much more precise. Some of them can be very, very precise, some less precise, but a PCR test is the more precise type of test. And a lateral flow test is potentially less precise. You require more of the antibodies, you require more of the virus in order to show up on a lateral flow test, but it's the sort of test that is done to ensure protection from those who are likely to be able to pass on the virus because they have the viral load to the level required to be identified by the lateral flow test. We've been advised that a lateral flow test is more than sufficient to be used for these purposes. And the system, Mr. Speaker, will be exactly the same as it has been until now. In other words, when you arrive at Gibraltar Airport, you'll have 24 hours to test, and you either do it literally at that moment or you can come back and do it. I want to emphasize, honorable members, this is the position that we have had throughout the period where we've had the air bridges in place, but with the air corridor closed. That is to say, this is the system we've had in place when the United Kingdom had much lower levels of adult first doses and therefore more prevalence of virus, and this has worked very well for us at the airport. Now that the United Kingdom has much less virus and more prevalence of adult first dose vaccinations, and indeed now surge vaccination in areas where the Indian variant is detected, we believe that this is absolutely the right approach. In other words, not to become more stringent, but to continue the position that we've had in place until now. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman said, well, if that is the case, people who arrive in Gibraltar and test in Gibraltar may find that they then have to spend time in isolation in Gibraltar if they have tested positive. That's absolutely the correct position. But, Mr. Speaker, it would have been the correct position anyway, in the sense that those who arrive in Gibraltar will have to take a test in order to be able to go back to the United Kingdom. And if those tests were found to be positive, they would have to stay in Gibraltar in isolation and miss their flights to the United Kingdom on return and rebook. Nobody is pretending that travel is going to be easy whilst we are still having to deal with what we might wish to call the after effects, at least, of the pandemic. But, of course, there is nothing to stop anyone taking a test before arriving in Gibraltar. Anybody can choose to do that if they don't want to find themselves in the situation of having to be in isolation when they get to any particular holiday destination. Mr. Speaker, they could do worse than isolating at the Caleta or any other one of our magnificent hotels, which the Honourable Member mentioned. Mr. Speaker, in terms of cost, there will be no cost to the government, because the government has ensured that in the context of the structure of the charge that we put in place for the tests on return to the United Kingdom, which we have fixed at £30, we have provided sufficient to cover all the administrative costs of carrying out those tests and the ability to have included a lateral flow test on arrival if necessary to be covered by the UK, the cost of the UK requirement of a test for the return to the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, there will be regulations under the Civil Contingencies Regulations to cover for this eventuality. And additionally, there is no requirement that somebody who comes to Gibraltar should have been vaccinated. The discussion has not really centred around a requirement for vaccinations for arrivals, either in Gibraltar or anywhere else in the world. The discussion is whether vaccination might eventually, because the coordination of those international vaccine passports has not yet been finalised, whether the vaccination would exempt you from testing requirements. So proof of vaccination might be tantamount to being able to show a negative PCR within the required period for entry. So there is no requirement, as far as the government is aware, for travel to the United Kingdom that somebody should be vaccinated, and there's certainly no requirement of vaccination for access to Gibraltar. And, Mr. Speaker, the government certainly would not support that being the case. The kite that the Honourable Member has flown, I think, is misguided for one reason in particular, which is that we certainly have no requirement that somebody who is accessing Gibraltar through the land frontier should be vaccinated. And so we would be very loath indeed to require somebody who's coming from the United Kingdom to us to be vaccinated if we're not making that requirement to somebody arriving to us from Spain or the rest of the European continent. Mr. Speaker, the question of the effect of vaccination on the Indian variant is one on which I said that the science was still at large and the advice is not yet there. There is anecdotal evidence of people who have the Indian variant 0.2. There are three Indian variants, 0.1, 0.2, and 0.3. The 0.2 has given rise to a number of cases of apparent hospitalization in those who have been vaccinated. The data is as yet very anecdotal. I referred the House to two cases reported to us by Dr. Cortez from the United States, and one case in the United Kingdom. But that is not sufficient to be able to make a scientific assessment. As far as we are advised, we don't make the scientific assessments. We are told by the scientist that that is not sufficient yet to be able to make a scientific assessment. It is expected that perhaps in the next 14 to 21 days, it will be possible to have a better view of what the effect of the vaccination is on the Indian variant of concern. There is a suggestion in some newspapers and in some other news outlets that the vaccinations are 95 to 97% effective against the Indian variant of concern, which would suggest the same level of immunity provided by the vaccination as against the Kent variant and the first of the coronaviruses that we are dealing with, but that data is not yet reliably there. And Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman therefore said to me, is this provision due to the uncertainty, or is it because there is some other concern or the data isn't there? Well, all of that, Mr. Speaker, is what creates the uncertainty. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, we think that a test for which travellers will not be charged, which is a test that will produce a result within 5 minutes and which will enable those arriving to take the test when they arrive or within 24 hours, as has been the case until now, I emphasise, is, we think, absolutely the right test to require now on arrival into Gibraltar until we have better data and science in respect of the Indian variant. And when we do, Mr. Speaker, I very much look forward to once again being able to say that testing will not be required on arrival to Gibraltar. Because the government of Gibraltar had made these statements before, and it's only in the last 24 hours that we have received this information, we additionally do not believe that it would be right to add any charge whatsoever to those coming to Gibraltar from the United Kingdom. It's for that reason that we will not charge, although we're confident that the cost of the test to leave Gibraltar will cover us for any bureaucratic cost experienced both on the arrival and departure testing. Mr. Speaker, I hope I've dealt with all of the questions that have been asked by the Honourable Member.
Papers to be laid, please, if you can. No,
I'm not allowed
to ask questions. Chief Minister,
proceed. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful. I just wanted to ask one question, really, about the consistency of the messaging coming out from Number 6 and the timing, Mr. Speaker. Now, Mr. Speaker, Chief Minister talked at the end of his reply to the Leader of the Opposition about this information just being received, but quite clearly notice about the variant B1617 and 0.2 and 0.3 was given to the United Kingdom back in October of 2020, and on the 21st of April 2021, the United Kingdom had approximately 1,800 cases of that variant in its sub-variant divisions, Mr. Speaker. The Chief Minister, on the 5th of May, in a number of TV appearances on Sky News and BBC, announcing to the world and inviting and promoting Gibraltar as a tourist destination, which all of us, of course, congratulate him for doing so, did obviously confirm that PCR testing was not required and there was no, effectively, there would be unregulated international travel to our shores, inviting, of course, the rest of the British family to descend on Gibraltar in their thousands in order to, of course, assist us in our recovery and assist those businesses who have been hard hit from the pandemic, Mr. Speaker. But as the Chief Minister will know, of course, on the 5th of May, when he gave that statement, there were over 1,800 cases of this variant, so the government must have been on
please
notice.
Please put your question.
Mr. Speaker, I really don't understand why I'm not allowed to develop a question.
But you are, your preamble has to be concise. We've talked about this before. So you ask the question, you seek clarification, you don't bring in other matters for the simple reason that it's not permissible. It's not permissible. Ask the questions. Clarify. It's for clarification purposes only.
This is a subject of quite public importance and of interest for members of the public and indeed people that will be coming to our shores to spend their time here. Mr. Speaker, I will make the point very briefly as follows. Mr. Speaker, as the Chief Minister knows, on the 5th of May, Professor Adam Finn, who is a member of the United Kingdom's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, said unregulated international travel can be very dangerous indeed. He told Sky News, Mr. Speaker, we certainly got our hands very comprehensively burnt when large numbers of people returned from holidays in Europe with the virus and set
the
pandemic going.
You need to ask the question.
I'm asking
on
a question,
the statement
Mr. Speaker.
That the Chief Minister has made.
Mr.
Please resume your seat now.
Mr. Speaker, I'll ask the question.
Please?
I'll ask the question.
Right.
Mr. Speaker, how does the Chief Minister reconcile the fact that on the 5th of May 2020, when clearly the Gibraltar government must have been on notice of thousands of cases of the Indian variant, and the fact that the medical advice being received about unrelated travel, that the government made statements about having no testing coming to our shores of many thousands of tourists, and now the position appears to have changed. And I just would like to understand from the Chief Minister why he was making statements back in the 5th of May when he had this scientific information surely available to him.
Mr. Speaker, as Leader of the House, I'd like to apologise to you for the intemperate way in which you have been addressed by the member who has just sat down. I represent all members of this House as Leader of the House, and I think all of us owe you the very greatest of respect at every time, in particular when we disagree with you. And that is how all games which involve a referee must be played. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member has read to me from a public source of information that which it is alleged by him was said on the 5th of May or a date around then by a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccinations in the United Kingdom. Obviously, unless he's just read that now, he would have had that information available to him. But I didn't hear him or any other member of his party raise with me, publicly or privately, after I made the announcement on Sky News that testing would not be required into Gibraltar, that perhaps we might be acting in a way that was not prudent. In fact, although the opposition appear these days, at least the official opposition appear these days, to be prepared to believe anything at the drop of a hat, apparently, with that information in hand, they did not seek to persuade the government to include a requirement of testing. So I'm surprised that now the Honourable Member seems to think that it makes sense to raise those issues. As far as the government is concerned, we have been entirely consistent in what we have said throughout, because everything we have said has been caveated by the fact that we might need to change our positions. Indeed, honourable members will know that Portugal at one stage had indicated it would be open to British travellers on the 17th of May, once they were put on the British green list. They then withdrew the fact that they would be open to arrivals from the United Kingdom as from the 17th of May, and then 72 hours later put themselves back on the list of those who would be receiving travellers from the United Kingdom. So, Mr. Speaker, this is a situation where the only consistency that there is in the world at the moment is the inconsistency that the virus visits upon us, and we have to be fleet of foot in the way that we are dealing with those things. The government is acting not based on information that one scientist may put out there in the context of an interview with one particular news agency. We're acting based on the advice of our scientists and the information which is made officially available from Downing Street, Mr. Speaker. That's why I emphasize to honourable members, I don't know whether any of them read a newspaper yesterday, but all the front pages yesterday were about exactly that issue. But I emphasize, Mr. Speaker, it was yesterday. It was yesterday. In the last 48 hours, the United Kingdom has started to say that there are issues with the Indian variant of concern in terms of how quickly it replicates, whether it replicates 40% faster, 50% faster, or 60% faster than the Kent variant. Those, Mr. Speaker, are the issues that have led us to make this decision. Now, when it comes to consistency, Mr. Speaker, the key question is whether honourable members opposite are going to demonstrate that they're consistently going to be supportive of the government and Gibraltar wanting to receive as many tourists as possible, or are they going to be consistently shown up for wanting to do anything or say anything that might somehow embarrass the government. After the last intervention, Mr. Speaker, it's very clear Mr. Phillips falls into the latter category, not the former.
I would ask the Leader of the Opposition that in future I would ask him to rein in Mr. Phillips, because I am not going to tolerate Mr. Phillips challenging me whenever he wishes. So I would ask you to bear that in mind. I'm a reasonable person, but I will not have the Honourable Mr. Phillips challenging everything I say, not everything, but lots of things that I say, and that is absolutely unacceptable.
Mr. Speaker, well, Mr. Speaker, can I not respond to you, to Mr. Speaker, given that?
If you're going to respond in the affirmative and that you are going to support the Speaker, fine.
Mr. Speaker, I always support the Speaker. I think I always do, and I think we're all reasonable people in this House. There are times that tempers fray, and the Honourable Member to my right was seeking to put a question forcefully. I mean, we hear what the Speaker said about it, and of course we always defer to Mr. Speaker's ruling. Mr. Speaker knows that. But equally, the members on this side of the House must have the ability to try to at least persuade Mr. Speaker that certain questions should be put, and the fact that tempers fray on both sides of the House, Mr. Speaker. It's not just on this side, and that's a reality. But we certainly hear loud and clear what Mr. Speaker has said.
I'm grateful to the Leader of the Opposition.
Papers to be laid. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've never been able to persuade anyone except my children by raising my voice with them. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the Referendum Voting Regulations 2021, the Crimes Amendment Act Referendum Regulations 2021, and the Gibraltar Annual Policing Plan for 2021-2022.
Ordered to lie.
We now proceed to answers to all questions. We commence with question number 1 of 2021, and the questioner is the Honourable E.J. Harris.
Mr. Speaker, sir, can the Minister for Sport say what alternative sporting venues are being provided for the Gibraltar Amateur Athletics Association during the period of non-availability of athletics facilities at either Laffrey Barracks or the Victoria Stadium?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Amateur Athletics Association continue to use the track at the Victoria Stadium and have commenced to use the track at the Laffrey Sports Complex.
Mr. Speaker, at the time I posed this question, the Athletic Association have been informed that due to works that were going to be carried out by the Football Association within the Victoria Stadium, they wouldn't be able to use the track. Does the Minister know whether those works have now been completed and therefore they're back to normal, or they've been delayed or something? Because my understanding was that the track there was not available.
Mr. Speaker, they are delayed. And on top of that, they asked whether they could use part of Lathbury, so, and we are doing so. We are allowing them to use Lathbury as well. So the Victoria Stadium is being used as well as Lathbury.
Yes, I think, thank you for that, Mr. Speaker. The Minister said, did he say part? Because from my last visit at Lathbury, I don't think the whole circuit was available. Perhaps he can enlighten us as to what actually is available.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, due to the works, as the Honourable Member says, that they are going on in Lathbury, there are only parts that can be used, so we've managed to allow them the part which is what is called the back straight in the Lathbury, so that because that is not being used and is okay, and we've checked it, they have checked it, we've checked the contract with the contractors so that they can safely go there, and it's to do with the fact that they've got some competitions coming ahead, and we've allowed them to use that because the Victoria, parts of the Victoria had problems, as the Honourable Member knows.
Next question.
Question number 2, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Can government provide updated details as to how many applicants are currently on the housing pre-list, showing the dates when they first joined this list?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, there are currently 169 applicants on the pre-list, broken down as follows. 5 applicants applied in May 20, 9 applicants applied in June 2020, 13 applicants applied in July 2020, 12 applied in August 2020, 23 applied in September 2020, 25 applicants applied in October 2020, 18 applicants applied in November 2020, 25 applicants applied in December 2020, 6 applicants applied in January 2021, 14 applicants applied in February 2021, 17 applicants applied in March 2021, and 2 applicants applied in April 2021.
Next question.
Question number 3, the Honourable Kaya Sopardi.
Mr. Speaker, how many persons were on the medical housing list on each of the following dates? 1, 31st December 2020, 2, 31st December 2019, 3, 31st December 2018, and 4, 31st December 2017, with a breakdown by medical categorization, prioritization, and their particular dwelling size needs.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 4, 5 and 6.
Question number 4, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, how many persons were on the medical housing list on the 30th of April 2021 with a breakdown by medical categorisation and their particular dwelling size needs?
Question number 5, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
How many persons were on the social housing list on each of the following dates? 31st December 2020, 31st December 2019, 31st December 2018, and 31st December 2017, with a breakdown by social categorization and their particular dwelling size needs.
Question number 6, the Honourable Kaya Sopardi.
How many persons were on the social housing list on 30th of April 2021 with a breakdown by social categorization and their particular dwelling size needs?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over a schedule with the information requested.
Mr. Speaker, can I just get clarification from the Honourable Member in respect of this list? So I've asked for how many people were on their, say, for example, medical list on a particular date. So let's just select the 2020 list. So on medical A+, there's 11, 1 RKB. There's 11 people on the 1 RKB list on the 31st of December 2020. That's the information the Honourable Member is giving me. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful. The reason I asked the question, and perhaps the Honourable Member can explain whether we're reading the statistics in the same way, is because the information that is available in the on the government website is headed, for example, when you, first of all, it doesn't have a specific, necessarily as specific a breakdown, but say on the medical list, it's headed applicants placed on the various medical housing lists in 2019. So for example, when you pick a date, the statistics that seem to be coming from the government are simply telling you how many people were placed on a particular list in a particular month, but not how many people were on that list. That's how I understand the statistics. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I hope we can agree to see how I understand it. The way I understand it is that, for example, the Honourable Member has mentioned the 2020 list. So if we go to the 2020, the way I understand it is that on 2020, one RKB, there are currently 11 on the A-plus list. A, there will be 8, B, there will be 1, and C, there won't be any. So the way I understand it is, on the date, on the last date, you've asked for 2020, and there were 11 1 RKB on 2020. So that's how I understand it, how it is currently.
I'm not sure if I understand the answer. What I'm saying, in essence, is this. I've asked the question to know how many people were on the housing lists, depending on the categories, on a specific date. The statistics on the government website suggest that that is not the information provided on the website, that what is being provided on the website is the number of people being placed on the list by category in a particular month, which won't necessarily give you the total statistic. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is correct, and there's a historical reason for that. When we introduced the provision of that statistical data, honourable gentlemen will recall that what we were doing was putting in a digital form, in a way that would be accessible by everyone, the questions that we, as an opposition, asked when we were on that side of the House. And we asked the question, Mr. Speaker, at every meeting of the House for on a monthly basis, how many people were placed on the list, because we ourselves did the follow-through of placed on list, and then there were other questions that we asked about how many people had had homes, etc., to try and do a reconciliation against the published list, which the government published once every year. So what we publish is the placed on the list. What the Honourable Gentleman asked for was, and he gave a specific date, which is the thing that we need if he wants an answer, how many were on the list on a specific date. I think, from memory, he has asked for the end of each year and the 31st or the 30th of April. So that's why there may be discrepancies. That's how we produce the list. As I've said before, and he may not have heard me because I don't know whether I've said it whilst he was here, if Honourable Members wish to see us add to what we publish on the website any particular statistic, which would then give them the information that they need before every house and would obviate their need for them to ask a statistical question, we're happy to add a specific parameter, so long as we can agree it, so that it can be published monthly also.
I'm grateful for the Honourable Member's answer, and certainly on this side of the House, it would help us not only to have the information that is currently on the website, which we understand is of a different nature, as the Chief Minister has just explained, but also to have, because, for example, the government puts on the website a monthly figure of people being placed on the list, it should then, at the end of the month, be able to know how many people are actually on the list by subcategory. So if that information could also be put on a separate list, I think it would be very helpful to members on this side of the House. Mr. Speaker, I was going to ask more supplementaries, but I think it's probably better if I digest the Honourable Members' tables and then I seek to ask more pointed supplementaries on a different occasion when I file other questions.
Next question. Question number 7, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, has the gentleman mentioned by Action for Housing on the 12th of April 2021, who was on the medical housing list priority A+, being rehoused or offered rehousing? If so, when, and if not, why not?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, no, he has not been housed, as he has not yet reached the top of the list.
Mr. Speaker, I assume, and I'm sure that is the practice of the Housing Department, that you don't get offered housing just when you get to the top of the very, very pinnacle of the housing list. There will be people who will be offered houses who are not necessarily at the very top, presumably, and that would be the experience of the Honourable Member, as it is the anecdotal experience of me when I've spoken to people. So, first of all, how high is he on the medical A-plus list? I'm not sure if his requirement is for a 1 RKB, for example. That would mean that, given the questions that I have asked, he is one of presumably 39 people on the medical A+. How high is he? Given that the Honourable Member has made public that he has discussed and visited the particular person, when can that particular person expect an offer of housing?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable gentleman has asked a question about a specific individual who is identifiable, because that person has been identified on television. We've responded to the question that the Honourable gentleman put, but to go further would be to disclose data about that individual beyond whether that person has been housed or not housed. If we give now the information of where that person is on the list, which is one of the things that the Honourable gentleman has asked, we may be sharing that information in a way that is, in fact, I think we would very likely be sharing that information in a way that is outside of the GDPR. So I would ask the Honourable gentleman not to press us on that particular aspect of his question. Perhaps we can share that information with the Honourable gentleman behind your chair. We would have no difficulty doing so, but we do not think that we can share that information publicly. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, I think that we have to be careful to understand that case and its relationship with other cases. The Honourable gentleman knows that the medical A-plus list, he has the information in front of him, has tripled, in effect, in the past year. So at the end of December 2020, there were 11 people awaiting an allocation of a one-bedroom flat. And 4 months later, 5 months later, there are 39 people awaiting a flat in the 1RKB category in medical A+. In the years before, there had been only 3 at the end of December 31st, 2017, 8 at the end of 31st December 2018, and 10 at the end of December 2019. The numbers have jumped. Of course, why, Mr. Speaker? For a number of reasons. We're going through a very difficult period. And secondly, at the moment, we're looking at the period in the middle of a year. When we get to the end of the year, it's very likely that number will have gone down again. Where is this individual on the list, and should he be helped out even more quickly than his ascension to the top of the medical A-plus list because of the reasons that the Honourable Gentleman has seen on television? Well, it's not possible to make a fair judgment, Mr. Speaker, without seeing video images and looking at the diagnosis that is relevant to all of the people who may be ahead of him on the list. So if I invite the Honourable Gentleman to make the assumption that given that this gentleman is very likely to have been on the list in 2020, medical A+, and seeking a one-bedroom, he is at least 11th on the list, or he was at that time. And then I remind him that when it comes to medical A, the hierarchy is not a hierarchy based on chronology but on diagnosis. And I invite him to assume that if the Honourable Gentleman's target has not already been housed, it's because the people who are above him on the list have a more acute diagnosis. I trust he will agree that it would be improper for the Minister for Housing to pluck that gentleman from where, based on the medical advice, he should be, and bring him to the top of the list simply because he has been on television. Because if we were to do that, Mr. Speaker, all that we would end up with would be 39 cases on television. There is in parallel, Mr. Speaker, a number we have given the Honourable Gentleman in answer to his question, a social list. And people who are on the social list are also potentially on the medical A list. The two are not mutually exclusive. And so there is a situation where an individual may not be the most acutely in need for medical reasons, but maybe the most acutely in need for social reasons. For example, the state of the hereditament where he may be living. Clearly that person has not come to the top of the social list either, which is a realization for all of us, Mr. Speaker, that what we saw on television is unfortunately not the worst medical condition that afflicts those who are waiting for housing, and not the worst social condition that afflicts those who are waiting for housing. And that is, Mr. Speaker, something that we all have to understand and deal with. But in the context of looking at those lists and see how low they were and how well managed they were, and knowing that every effort will be spared to ensure that by the time we get to the end of the year, the list will once again have returned to the place that they were when we were last reporting them, which was just over a handful and less than a handful, Mr. Speaker, in the years before that. So, Mr. Speaker, when you put it in that context, I know we'll agree that it would be tremendously unfair to look at this case in isolation, to just concentrate on this case and to ignore all of the others, some of which may be even more meritorious than the very meritorious case that we saw played out for us all in those images that were shared on television.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to ask about the specific case for the reasons the Honourable Member is talking about. Certainly we all want people in those kinds of conditions to be rehoused as soon as possible and addressed as soon as possible. If he's not the worst case, well then, if there are worst cases out there, well then, that's even more pressing a need for the government to do so. And I'm sure the government will agree that it needs to give priority to that. And indeed, the minister has spoken about a percentage of the 176 allocations going to people on the medical list, and perhaps the government will consider giving more priority and a higher percentage to people on the medical and social list, because at the end of the day, there are reasons why they are there. The question I had for the Honourable Member, which I'm not really sure I understand, is he has quite correctly observed that the numbers for April are very different to the ones at the end of the year, but the difference is only 4 months. So the numbers have gone up, have shot up tremendously. So, for example, from on the 31st of December, A plus 11 people on the 1RKB to 39, and on the medical A, they've also shot up significantly from 8 to 37. Now, what I did not understand from the Honourable Member's explanation is why he thinks that that is seasonal. I don't follow why it is that the Honourable Member is, I thought, trying to explain that the numbers will come down by the end of the year, but taking a snapshot now explains why the numbers should have gone up. Why is that, and why has there been, in the Honourable Member's assessment, in the last 4 months, such an increase in the medical and social lists?
Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition is urging the government to do exactly what the government is doing. So he can consider us urged of our own motion and without the need for him to do so. Because of course we understand that people who are in a medical A category have greater needs than perhaps others do. Of course we understand that they should be given more priority, and they are. Vide, Mr. Speaker, the numbers that I've referred to a moment ago. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, very often, not always, many of the cases that are referred to will be cases that have been on the list for not through the years. In other words, if you were on the list in 18, you wouldn't have been, one of the eight on the list in 18 is unlikely to be one of the 11 on the list in 20. So there is a churn there. The numbers are not the same individuals. But, Mr. Speaker, the 4 months, the 5 months, I mean, four full months, because the Honourable Gentleman asked us for the numbers as at the end of April. The four full months that the Honourable Gentleman is talking about have probably been the four most difficult in our history. I mean, we celebrated the fact, and I think it's very good news, despite this case, which has seemed to cast a pall over it, that last year we gave 176 homes, Mr. Speaker. In a year which was marked by the pandemic, we were able to churn 176 homes. Yes, we didn't manage to find a home for this gentleman who made it onto television. But what about the other 176 success stories? In this context, the number of 176 ends in the 31st of December last year, because we were counting calendar years. Then you have what we are loosely calling, I'm sure we are all calling it that, so I will allow myself to fall into the vernacular, Lockdown 2, which starts at the end of last year and goes through most of March. And that means, Mr. Speaker, we can't get people into people's homes to do repairs. We can't even have people in close proximity working together in an apartment in order to prepare an apartment for handover. So if the Honourable Gentleman asked me for my diagnosis of what it is that happened in the 4 months between the 31st of December 2020 and the 30th of April 2021, Mr. Speaker, that is what happened. That is what stymied us so greatly. But it is also true, Mr. Speaker, that there is consistency in the date that he asked the question in relation to the earlier years, the 31st of December. Now he's asked for a date which is in April. I've given him my diagnosis of the issues between now and then. If you ask for a snapshot at any other time, for example, if you asked, what about on the 30th of April 2019? I'm not saying it's seasonal, Mr. Speaker. I'm not saying that in April 2019 the numbers would have been higher than 10 and closer to 39, because this is ebbs and flows throughout the year. What I'm saying, Mr. Speaker, is that this year we've had the problem that we've had leading up to April. But at any time, if you chose a different date, this is a snapshot. So you might have some other sociological or anthropological reason why a snapshot on another date might produce a different number. I can tell the Honourable Gentleman, he might recall this from the time that he was a minister, indeed the Honourable, the former leader of the opposition, I won't describe what that is in abbreviations today, might recall that one can have many, 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 many people claiming to be unemployed on the 30th of July wanting to see a minister. But very few people claiming to be unemployed wanting to see a minister on the 14th of August. And so when people go on the list, when people want a meeting, when people are assessed for things, sometimes it does ebb and flow seasonally. And Mr. Speaker, on this one, I think that the huge increase that we have seen, we're seeing the list almost quadruple in the one RKB, that is exclusively related to the inability of the Housing Works Agency to do in the first months of this year the fantastic job that they had done in the 12 months of the year before, except for the couple of months when they were also locked down and not yet be able to give us homes to be able to hand over to those deserving applicants on our list.
Next question.
Question number 8, the Honourable Keir Soparidi.
Mr. Speaker, is the government considering reforms to the Housing Act in respect of private housing stock? And if so, what is the nature of the proposed reforms envisaged?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the pre-war private rental sector suffers from systemic problems created by over 80 years of various forms of rent control. These problems often result in tenants living in substandard conditions and landlords in turn unable to adequately maintain their properties as a result of inadequate rental homes. Income. Whereas the government is keen in incentivizing the renewal of the build environment, particularly the upper town, it is also mindful of the need to protect the rights of tenants living in these pre-war properties. As a result, we have been meeting with all key stakeholders of this sector as part of a thorough and extensive review of the Housing Act. A bill will be presented to this House in the near future. Mr. Speaker, any changes to the Housing Act will need to address the difficulties experienced by this sector in a holistic way, and one which strikes the right balance between the safeguards against unfair evictions and exorbitant rents sought by tenants, the economic efficiency and ability to maintain buildings sought by the landlord, and the need to ensure that the Housing Department can continue to maintain its ability to allocate government housing to people on the housing waiting lists and who are currently tenants of pre-war properties.
Does the Minister have an expectation of when that bill would be prepared? Is it, for example, that they are in the consultation stages of all those relevant groups and the drafting has not begun, or is it that the drafting of legislation has begun so that the government has already scoped the kind of objective it wants to put into that legislation? Is the legislation only going to deal with the private housing market, or is it going to go beyond that? Because, as the Minister knows, the Housing Act has different parts. But the question that I asked was specifically in relation to private housing stock. So I'm taking that the Honourable Member's answer was also related to private housing stock, but I want to understand that the legislation he's talking about is about specifically the private housing market that we certainly share on this side of the House. The view expressed that after so many decades of rent control legislation, that of course previous generations of Gibraltar decision makers introduced for good reason, now would need to be reviewed in the context of modern Gibraltar to make sure that we find a better way forward, because clearly in the private housing market there are those tensions that the Honourable Member has spoken about. So perhaps he could explain with a bit more detail the kind of timescale and where the government is on all those objectives.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Since I became minister, which was October 19, I've been working through the pandemic and all that to do the part one, is already basically consolidated. There might be tweaks here and there, but the part one deals with the public housing. So part one is basically done. We are moving very fast on to part two. The consultation exercise has already happened. We've already had representations from different stakeholders as to the part two. What I am now doing is also getting advice from the rent assessor. I'm getting advice from other parties, and what I intend to do in the, I would reckon in the next month or two, is to sit down, because what we did in the part one, I intend to do in the part two, so the Honourable Member understands, is going clause by clause as to, and I have also read a paper which even the Honourable Member sent himself as a lawyer, which advised us on how to deal with it. I'm even reading that one. So we're looking at all stakeholders who have made representation to the Housing Department to see how we can get on with part two. But I can tell the Honourable Member that in the next month or two, what we do is we're going to all the people around the table will sit down, go clause by clause, to see how best we can deal with this systemic problem. It is a systemic problem. There is a complete distortion of rents from public to private, and those private to the new estates. In private estates, I mean the new build, from people who are paying rents from 2,000, 3,000 a month to housing, our local housing, who pay from 20 to 30 to 40 pounds a month. So you can just imagine the distortion there is. It's very, very difficult to keep everybody happy. It's very, very difficult to protect everyone as well. So it is a very difficult job, but I am confident that we will sit down and try to find the right balance.
Next question.
Question number 9, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state how many applications for disability benefit have been made since the 1st of January 2018 and the date in which each one was A, determined and B, remain undetermined?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Employment and Social Security.
Mr. Speaker, we'll answer this question together with question 10.
Question number 10, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Mr. Speaker, please state how many appeals against the refusal of disability benefit have there been since the 1st of January 2018 and the date in which each one of them was A, determined and B, remain undetermined?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Employment and Social Security.
Mr. Speaker, 249 applications for disability benefits have been made since the 1st of January 2018. 198 applications have been determined on the dates detailed in the schedule I now hand over. 51 applications remain undetermined. There have been 45 appeals since the 1st of January 2018. 38 of these appeals have been determined on the dates detailed in the schedule I have handed over. Of the 45 appeals made, 7 remain undetermined.
Daniel Feetham, or you want, sorry.
Mr. Speaker, I intend to analyse this carefully, these figures, and then come back, probably at another session, but if there is anything that arises from this, I just ask Mr. Speaker's indulgence perhaps later on in the session, but we can carry on if that meets with Mr. Speaker's approval.
Yes.
Question number 11, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education provide details in respect to the number of students following vocational qualification courses in A, Hair and Beauty, B, Digital Technologies, and C, any other vocational course, indicating the level of qualification expected to be obtained, the course completion date, with details of the educational establishments which are delivering these courses?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Speaker, we have 24 students undertaking hair and beauty vocational courses. There are 86 students currently undertaking the digital technologies qualification. We must not forget that we also have 81 students at our comprehensives and 285 students at the Gibraltar College who are following courses which are vocationally assessed. This does not include students who at some point in their journey are completing ASDAN qualifications which are vocationally assessed at levels 1 and 2 at our comprehensive schools. We are hoping to offer further vocational courses in the near future, and there are discussions ongoing with potential providers and awarding bodies. Mr. Speaker, these are level 1 and 2 qualifications.
Mr. Speaker, I was asking for the educational establishments providing the courses. I know the Minister said that, you know, between the secondary schools and comprehensives there were 81 and plus 285 following vocational assess, but I mean specifically on the hair and beauty, like the digital technologies, I'm not clear which establishments are offering these.
Speaker, the hair and beauty is being offered both at the college and at the course is actually being carried out in Bayside, but it's for students from both Bayside and Westside. And the digital technology qualifications are for Bayside and Westside students. And they are GCSE equivalent, so it's that at that stage.
All right, so GCSE equivalent means that it's a level two, yeah? And I asked for the completion date of the course because I need to establish whether it's a course that's sort of finishing now or this is now currently only the first year of a two-year course. Perhaps the Minister can guide us on that.
The GCSE qualifications, they started, I believe they started last year, so they should be finishing this year. It's a two-year course.
And therefore, Mr. Speaker, if this is the second of a two-year course, there are no students out of, for example, those 24 who have undertaken only the first year only and will then finish by June 22. If the Minister has information now, I don't mind waiting and he can then get us more details. But we can't quite establish, you know, who is just within the first of the two-year courses and who's in the second, so we know what the continuity rates are like.
Mr. Speaker, I'll take advice on that and give the Honourable Member the breakdown during the course of this meeting.
Mr. Speaker, returning to question 10 and question 9 and 10. Mr. Speaker, the schedule that the Honourable Minister has provided me with respect doesn't answer the question that I have asked. I have asked the question at 9 in relation to disability benefit, the date in which each one of them was A, determined, and B, remained determined. Now, what I'm after, essentially, is when an application was made, and if that application remains undetermined. So, from our point of view, the interest is this. If there's an application that's been filed, let's say, on the 15th of February 2018, which is the first one on the list, if that remains undetermined, then, of course, it's an application that was filed 3 years ago. So we would seek to probe, well, why is it taking so long for that to be undetermined? Does the Minister have the information as to, in relation to the information and the list that he's provided of when the application has been made, which one of these actually remains undetermined? And essentially, it's the same question in relation to appeals, because very helpfully, the government's provided the date in which we asked, the date in which the appeal was lodged. What it doesn't say is, in relation to each one of those, which one remains, which appeal remains undetermined. Does he have that information?
Mr. Speaker, no, I don't. What I do have is obviously what was said in the reply to the question, that 198 applications were determined. Obviously, the rest have not been determined of the total of 249. So it gives the Honourable Member an indication of how many appeals or how many applications for disability benefits have not been determined. So there's a number of undetermined appeals, but I couldn't specifically say it's the one of the 15th or the one of the 18th or the one of the 21st. I don't know whether information is possible to perhaps it must be, but I mean I need to find out.
Yes. You see, Mr. Speaker, we know that there is 51 that out of the 249 that remain undetermined. If those 51 are ones that have been made in 2020, it's perfectly understandable why they would remain undetermined. We've had COVID, we've had all those issues, and the government would have a perfectly reasonable explanation as to why they remain undetermined. If they date back to 2018, it's a different kettle of fish. Can the minister at least undertake to write to me, providing me with the information, and then I can then ask any further questions at the next session of the House. But I did think that my question was clear enough for the Minister to have come to the House today in order to provide me with information.
Mr. Speaker, I will seek the relevant information the minister, the member is requesting, but I would assume that an application date in 2018 would have been determined by now. I mean, otherwise it would have been here, you know, out there. So I can assume, again, it is an assumption that those that are that remain undetermined are the more recent ones caught up, you know, with the pandemic and the issues, recent issues. But again, I will endeavour to seek that information that the honourable member is requesting.
I'm very grateful to the minister because I know of one constituent that tells me that her application has been outstanding for several years. And that's the reason why I've asked this question. So if he can provide me that information, I'm very grateful.
Next question. Question number 12, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Can the Minister for Education provide this House with updated details in respect of all vacant teaching posts, identifying the school stroke establishment where these may exist, together with the grade they pertain to, and further indicating how many are being covered in an acting capacity and by when it is expected these posts will be allocated on a substantive basis?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the information is provided in the schedule that is now being taken over to the Honourable Member. Arrangements are being made to advertise these posts, which are being filled as soon as possible after they become vacant. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member will see, in relation to the question of how many are being acted, the footnote to the schedule indicates three posts which are not currently being acted. I'm sure he will ask me why. I'll answer that when he asks me.
Yes, certainly, Mr. Speaker, it jumps out straight away. Can the minister give me the reasons why those three are not being filled on an acting capacity?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, they are TLRs. The honourable member knows that these are the responsibility posts. And the whole subject of TLRs has been under discussion for quite a number of years. I am happy to say that recent meetings which involve the Department of Education, the Human Resources Department, and the NASUWT, the Teachers Union, have come to agreement on most of these posts, but there are still these three posts where we are not certain, Mr. Speaker, whether they will continue in that format or whether they have to be reviewed in the light of development in the different schools, and those are still under discussion, and therefore they're not being filled at the moment.
I don't think I'll have any further questions to arrive, Mr. Speaker, but if I do, within the next sort of few minutes, I'll come in so I don't delay the proceedings of this House.
Next question. Question number 13, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state that it will strengthen laws to protect animals from neglect and cruelty?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure this will not be an area of controversy between us. Over the past few years, the government has published at least six items of legislation which strengthen the laws to protect animals from neglect, cruelty and abuse in Gibraltar and beyond our shores. Some of these have drawn the attention of and congratulations from international organisations. These include the Animals and Birds Amendment No. 3 Act 2018, which included a new part, Part 5A, entitled Animals in Distress, which covers a wide variety of behaviours which can lead to cruelty and neglect, and also introduces a 5-year sentencing provision, well ahead, for example, of the UK, which I believe introduced this only last month. This Act also banned capturing of cetacea for dolphinaria or other non-medical purposes, created cruelty offence for animals, and provided for police powers to help animals in distress. The Animals in Travelling Circuses Act 2019 banned the use of animals in travelling circuses. The Import and Export Control Amendment Regulations 2019 banned the import and export of hunting trophies. The Pet Animal Sales Amendment Act 2019 imposed certain conditions related to animal welfare on licenses for pet shops, such as limiting species to be sold and prescribing a minimum age for the sale of animals, mainly puppies and kittens. Also required breeders of dogs and cats to be approved to ensure certain standards, and an amendment to the animal rules was also made so that you cannot import dogs and cats under 4 months old for commercial purposes. This was the Animals Amendment Rules 2019. The Animals and Birds Amendment No. 3 Act 2018 and the Ivory Act 2019 banned trade, export and import of ivory. Mr. Speaker, indirectly, the release of Balloons Regulations 2019 was also designed to protect marine wildlife. Finally, Mr. Speaker, as recently as February this year, this House passed the Animals Amendment No. 2 Act 2021 in relation to cruelty to service animals, popularly known as Finn's Law. In this instance, cruelty perpetrated against an animal in public service is an aggravating factor when considering the appropriate sentence. Mr. Speaker, I continue to review all animal welfare laws, keeping track of developments elsewhere. For example, at the moment, we are looking into reviewing the definition of dangerous dogs.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Honourable Gentleman's repeat of the legislation that the GSLP government have passed and introduced to protect animals more generally. And he is right about the 2018 amendment provision, which I had a look at in some detail, given the fact that it does provide for the importation, of course, of diseased animals and destruction orders, and particularly in relation to distress orders, as they're loosely described, Mr. Speaker. I wouldn't agree that they encapsulate a general approach by the government in terms of the cruelty aspect, and I say it for this reason. The Honourable Gentleman will recall two cases this year of horrific circumstances which animals were unfortunately met their end in extreme circumstances where the courts imposed penalties of 8 months and 4 months respectively. There was a mini public outcry by those that have a significant interest in the welfare of animals as to what powers the government have, or at least what powers the authorities have in our community to stop people who are charged and then prosecuted and found guilty of those offences where there has been extreme suffering on behalf of the pet, or the animal in this case, and what the government would do in terms of introducing legislation that would prevent these individuals looking after animals or exposing to incidents where they might impose those mechanisms of cruelty on them again. And I think that was the point in which this question was engineered, because most of the legislation that the Honourable Gentleman has alluded to stems from the 1948 legislation, which of course is very outdated. And I just wondered whether the Minister had any information as to whether any legislation would be brought to this House to effectively prohibit people that are convicted of these offences from owning animals in the future.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Member had assisted the House by specifically asking that question, then I would have brought information which was relevant to that. I think, Mr. Speaker, I don't have to tell the Honourable Member, as he is a lawyer in practice, that because he referred to the penalties imposed on these cases, that is for the court to impose. The maximum sentence is 5 years. It's the court that then imposes the sentence, and that is something that certainly I would not influence. And as a magistrate in part two, I completely understand that it is not for a minister to impose a penalty. I believe that in the past, courts in Gibraltar, possibly under the Animals Act, have precluded members of the public from owning dogs. I may be mistaken. I'm going back to my memory while I was sitting on the bench. I will certainly check that. But this is part of the review of the dangerous dogs definition. Because there is a growing school of thought that it is not the dog that is dangerous, but the way the dog is looked after and the ability of the owner to look after the dog in a way that is not going to make it aggressive. And this is precisely what I was referring to in the review of definition of dangerous dogs and so on. So this is certainly a matter that has come to my attention and that I am actively looking at.
Mr. Speaker,
Just a point of clarification. Of course, I understand how a court operates and when it imposes penalties and the minister's not there to do it, unless he's sitting as a GP, of course. And of course, I'm sure he wouldn't want to impose his views in this House on that. And, you know, the point of the question was to say what the government would be doing to strengthen laws to protect animals from neglect and cruelty. Of course, part of that would be allowing for a particular power of those charged with imposing those types of penalties, with allowing them to prevent people from owning animals in the future when they have, in the words of the judge in the 8-month sentence, there was obvious extreme suffering by that particular pet when he met his sad end. So I think this question is really born out of approaches from members of the public as to where is the power, and I couldn't find the power, and where it can be utilised in the appropriate circumstances, Mr. Speaker. And if there isn't a power, of course, I would ask the Honourable Gentleman to see whether he's looking at the review of sort of allowing for that to come to this House so we can debate it.
Mr. Speaker, I will look, because I believe that there was a power. And certainly, I think the Honourable Member will agree, and I know the Honourable Mr. Feetham has been very keen and very supportive of a lot of the laws that we have passed in this House over the last few years. And I think he will agree that we have made huge strides in improving animal laws in this House, well in advance of the United Kingdom. As I say, the sentence of 5 years, I believe it was only last month that it received, I believe, royal assent. So, Mr. Speaker, absolutely, I will look into this. Certainly, persons who are convicted of this kind of extreme cruelty, I agree, should not be allowed to own pets. And if there is no provision in the law that covers that, then I will certainly look into making sure that I either bring to this House if it requires primary legislation, or look at the animal rules and see how that could be brought about. And I'm sure the whole House will agree with that.
The Honourable Daniel Feetham.
Speaker, I know that this may sound a tad perhaps extreme to some people, but I have long thought that in fact people that have imposed that kind of cruelty on animals should actually go on a list and should go on a public list, not only so that in this jurisdiction you are able to identify the people that are that subjected animals to that kind of cruelty, but in other jurisdictions as well. And I would invite the government to do that and ask to formulate it in a question. Will the government also consider introducing something along those lines?
Mr. Speaker, certainly something that I would be happy to consider.
Next question.
Question number 14, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state whether it will bring legislation before the House to deal with noise pollution in Gibraltar?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, not at present, as there is already considerable existing legislation.
Mr. Speaker, the issue of noise pollution obviously is a significant one for members of the public. The complaints that we receive on this side of the House, apologies, there's been some noise on my side of the bench, in relation to construction noise,
silence, please,
exhaust noise, and of course the noise emanating from certain vessels in the bay, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Gentleman will know, of course, about the WHO recommend, the World Health Organization recommendations, who have stated on numerous occasions that noise pollution has a very significant effect on the physical and mental well-being of citizens, and that the government should be trying to reduce the decibel levels within their communities. So, Mr. Speaker, my understanding of the current position is that the noise action plan, which I believe is prepared by his department, and indeed noise mapping, which is a process which I believe is undertaken, are those processes that are currently in train? Because as far as I understand from the noise action plan, of course, that leads up to 2018 only, and does highlight issues, important issues of noise pollution in our community. And I do understand that from my sources, in fact, that the government is already considering legislation. So I'm not too sure whether that fits with what the Honourable Gentleman said about that. So maybe my sources are completely wrong, but I have given to understand that the government may be considering drafting legislation in the area of noise pollution more generally to comply with those matters.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very clear on the dangers of noise and on the negative impact of noise on the community. There are, however, Mr. Speaker, a wide variety of laws that already cover it. And the Honourable Member has mentioned a few examples. Looking through the notes that I have had prepared, I believe most of them are covered. It may be a question of enforcement, but if the Honourable Member wishes to point out any specific area of noise which he believes is not covered in legislation, then I will most certainly look at it and see whether we can bring some legislation to this House.
I think generally that the members of the community that approach me on this subject relate to the fact that they also don't have anywhere to go when they complain about it. So, for instance, if they go to the environmental agency, they turn around and say it's not their issue, it's a port issue, especially from noise coming from vessels. So eventually it's a full circle argument and no one really can get the answer. And this is the difficulty that members of the public are having. And the information that I certainly was receiving, I don't know whether Mr. Kavanagh, if there is no legislation that the government is considering in terms of noise pollution more generally, that's fine. But those are the types of complaints that I'm receiving.
Mr. Speaker, I'm aware that the Environmental Agency receives complaints, and if they are to do with activity in relation to ships, they will refer to the Port Department or the Port Authority, but I would be, if it's happened, it's happened, Mr. Speaker, but I am not aware of any case in which they would, so to speak, pass the buck to somebody else. They would themselves take it up with the Port Authority, as they do, for example, in the case of smells and so on. So the port of call, if you'll excuse the pun, is certainly the Environmental Agency. They keep records of these complaints, and I am aware that there have been some periods of time where there have been complaints, and they should be dealt with. If they are not, then clearly I would be interested to know, but I am confident that they are following up. But once again, if there are any gaps in the legislation that the Honourable Member is aware of, I'd be more than happy to look at them and to deal with them.
Next question. Question number 15, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state what relationship the government has with Knightsfield Holdings Limited and what services the company provides the government?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 16 and 17.
Question number 16, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state the sites covered by any contractual arrangement with Knightsfield Holdings Limited?
Question number 17, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the names of the ultimate beneficial owners of Knightsfield Holdings Limited?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government has a contractual relationship with Knightsfield Holdings Limited for the management and running of the Gibraltar National Museum, Gorham's Cave World Heritage Site, Parsons Lodge and the Moorish Castle. It is not the practice in this House to provide details of beneficial owners, especially as this is now publicly available information.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman insofar as Knightsfield Holdings Limited. The reason I ask that, of course, because we understand the shareholders are those people charged with responsibility of the museum. So I don't need to take it any further than that. One of my questions obviously relates to those services that the company has provided. I don't think the Honourable Gentleman has really been any more helpful than just to say that it runs the museum, Gorham's Cave Complex. I asked what services the company provides the government. It would be helpful if the Honourable the Minister could explain what those services are.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the running of the Gibraltar National Museum means looking after the collection, looking after the inventory, having the employees attending to the public, carrying Gorham's Cave World Heritage Site. We know about the archaeological dig. They also organise the Kalpa conferences. Parsons Lodge currently not open to the public, but is used as a centre for research. it's very, very wide. National Museum, Gorham's Cave, Parsons Lodge, they are the services, the running of these sites and facilities.
I'm grateful for the answer to that question. You know, ultimately, I think it's right, isn't it, that these are our main national assets. If you look at Moorish Castle, Parsons Lodge, Gorham's Cave, the museum, these are national assets that belong to our community and should be shown to the wider public in terms of the tourist product. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but I don't think that is a logical corollary of the questions that has been asked.
I agree. You don't have to answer that question.
Mr. Speaker, the services that are provided by the company, do they include interface with the public in terms of tourism? That's a logical question from that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very, very happy to answer. Yes, it does. It includes interface with the public at the National Museum. It includes interface with the public at the Gorham's Cave viewing platform, which is open for visitors. It includes the trips to Gorham's Cave as and when they can be arranged, and trips to other assets as and when they are necessary. So yes, it does include interface with the public.
Mr. Speaker, according to the approved estimates, of course, we spend for those contracted services about 61% of the entire budget for heritage on those contracted services, about £1.145 million. Does the government agree with me, or not agree with me, that is value for money for what is being produced?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is value for money. I mean, we must remember the value of the World Heritage Site, which is probably something that cannot be converted into a monetary value.
Supplementary question. Is it right that the contracted services, that there is more than one contract? I assume that there's one contract dealing with, from Knightsfield, Moorish Castle, Parsons Lodge, the Gibraltar Museum, Stay Behind Tunnels, Casemates Vault, and another contract that deals specifically with Gorham's Cave. Is that right? That's my understanding.
There is a separate contract for the World Heritage Site. Yes, Mr. Speaker, these contracts are not new. The World Heritage Site happened later, but certainly the museum contract and so on is a continuation of contracts that were in place before we came into power.
Next question.
Question number 18, the Honourable DJ Bosino.
Can the government guarantee that it would ensure that Gibraltar's World War II cement heritage will be protected?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The Heritage and Antiquities Act 2018 protects a substantial number of World War II sites, including the Stay Behind Cave Complex, the World War II Tunnel Complex, including Great North Road, Culper Hole Generating Station and Hales Devil, the Anti-Tank Teeth at Winston Churchill Avenue, and Fort Garry, Fort George, and Fort MOT, located at Eastern Beach. There are also a substantial number of World War II listed sites in the Northern Defences. It's important to note that although not all World War II pillboxes are listed by name, the majority of our defensive walls, batteries and bastions listed include World War II cement heritage that abuts them. Works cannot be undertaken on or near these sites unless a Minister for Heritage provides a heritage license after receiving advice from the Heritage and Antiquities Council. Even if sites are not listed, town planning and building control permission must be given, and the Ministry for Heritage and the Gibraltar Heritage Trust are consulted at that stage. Works were recently undertaken by the Gibraltar Heritage Trust and Ministry for Heritage to restore Fort Canada, as an example, a World War II pillbox built by the Royal Canadian Engineers immediately adjacent to the tunnel to Devil's Bellows. An information panel is being designed to accompany the restoration. Other World War II assets that have been restored include World War II pillboxes and bunkers at the Europa Sports Stadium complex. Information panels showcasing the history of these sites will also be installed. World War II assets have also been restored at the new wine vaults development at Devil's Tower Road. A substantial number of World War II cement heritage are also being protected and will be restored within the northern defences. In short, Mr. Speaker, the answer is yes, sir. Perhaps I should have said that at the beginning.
You did. I did.
Thank you. You did, I think. Thank you. Thank you for the. I'm grateful to the Minister for the very lengthy reply and very full reply. I've heard that there are the plans to remove what I think are pillboxes in the Casemates, I think it's called Casemates Parade, where the Grand Bastion is. Can he shed some light in relation to that? Clearly, given the answers just given, the answer I would expect would be no, but that's what I've heard, and I wanted to put that to him.
Mr. Speaker, I have not heard, and certainly they would have to come to my office for permission anyway, and would also have to be picked up in planning. I have no information on that, Mr. Speaker.
And also, Mr. Speaker, in relation to, I don't know where the planning stage of that particular development is, if it has prospered or not, but in relation to the Sandy Bay development, I think he knows which one I mean, beyond both worlds going in a southerly direction. There are also, I think, some cement World War II heritage sites there. I think pillboxes again on this occasion. Is he able to give us some comfort in relation to that those will remain untouched and protected, despite should the development proceed?
Mr. Speaker, that is still subject to the planning process. I believe my latest information is that the monuments themselves would not be negatively affected. That is subject to confirmation when the whole planning process goes. But my information is that the structures themselves would not be negatively affected. Whether the development will affect it in other ways, visually or whatever, is not the subject of this question, nor of this answer. But there's still a long way to go, because that process has only just commenced.
In relation to that specific issue, does he have a view in relation to that, whether he will intervene and ensure that they are protected, however which way that will materialise?
Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Member has ever watched or listened to the DPC meetings, he knows the answer to that question.
So there's a possibility...
Last question.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. So there's a possibility that his view will be sidelined and ignored and those pillboxes destroyed? Is that within the realms of possibilities?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think it's appropriate for us to discuss a proposal that is still subject to the planning process. And I have already said that as far as I am aware, those structures themselves would not be negatively affected.
Next question. Question number 19, the Honourable D.J. Vosino.
Does the government have any plans to ensure that the legacy of artillery on the Rock is maintained for future generations?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. Perhaps I should sit down now. For example, the Ministry for Heritage is undertaking the restoration and protection of much of our artillery by installing tampions in our cannons depicting the coat of arms of the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. This is an ongoing maintenance project that was started last year. The Ministry for Heritage, together with volunteers from the Gibraltar Heritage Trust and the Ministry of Defence, is also undertaking works on artillery pieces at Lord Eyre's and will soon commence works at O'Hara's and at Devil's Gap. The Ministry has also taken possession and restored artillery pieces from the MOD, including a 24-pounder from Devil's Tower training camp. Ministry is also currently in discussion with MOD with a view to taking over a number of other pieces, including a Beaufort's at Bufadero and a 24-pounder from Rock Gun Battery. The Gibraltar Heritage Trust and the Ministry, with the assistance of Selina Limited, also restored a naval gun that was in an abandoned state above Devil's Bellows. The gun is now at the Napier of Magdala Battery for all to see. Together with the Gibraltar National Museum, the museum, which is also custodian of a number of artillery pieces, the Ministry is supporting the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, who are working on developing a gun park. The Ministry for Heritage has also completed a list of all guns and artillery on the Rock, each with its own unique identification code that will be displayed on its forthcoming website. This includes all place guns and embedded guns, some of which are already listed in the Heritage and Antiquities Act 2018. So, Mr. Speaker, for the first time ever, we have what we believe is a complete list of all ordnance pieces on the rock.
Again, I'm grateful to the Honourable Member for that very full and lengthy reply, which I will consider in greater detail in the future. But there's a particular question I'd like to ask, Mr. Speaker, and this arises from an article which appeared in the Gibraltar Chronicle in relation to Lord Airy's battery, where Mr. Jackson, who I understand is a member of Fortress of Gibraltar Group, which are dedicated to ensuring that these, or assist the government, I think, to ensuring that these sites are maintained and improved and refurbished. But he had this to say, and with your permission, I'd like to quote from very briefly from the article, Mr. Speaker. It says, "The Heritage Trust said Mr. Jackson's passion for the refurbishment of projects was apparent during these tours, but he lacks solid funding and manpower for the task at hand." And then lastly, he says, and I quote, "The legacy of artillery on the rock is dwindling, with scant emphasis placed on the preservation of these old guardians of our freedom," Mr. Jackson said. Does he have any comment to make in relation to this, given that on the face of it, it appears, Mr. Speaker, to be an indictment of the government's relation to this particular issue?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is a fact that after when we came in, and I wasn't the first Minister for Heritage in this government, my friend and colleague, the Honourable Sibylle Niles, was, we found there had been so much neglected in the previous 16 years, I have to say that some was irrecoverable. In relation to Pete Jackson, he's an old friend. He's a trustee of the Heritage Trust, I believe, currently. He does wonderful work. And he has been supported, certainly by my ministry, in being given a location for him to carry out a lot of his restoration work. He is encouraged to do this with volunteers. I am not aware of him requesting any specific assistance which would not ordinarily be denied, provided it is clearly affordable. A lot of this work is quite specialized work. I think Pete will not be able to do all of it and will be needing some support. But as I said before, we are working with the Ministry of Defense, who traditionally, in some of the exercises that take place in Gibraltar, do volunteer to carry out restoration work. Particularly that which is perhaps more technical and more difficult to achieve. But I am satisfied, Mr. Speaker, that we're doing a fine job in restoring our artillery. I can tell him that if not last week, this week, work is commencing on the various pieces of artillery in Princess Caroline's, Princess Amelia's area. They do suffer a lot, clearly, from the weather and exposed sites, and from the attention of yellow-legged gulls who may sit on them occasionally. So it is a job that has to be kept going. But I am confident that we are doing a better job than has ever been done, Mr. Speaker.
I wasn't in government. People, not me personally. No, I don't think I was either. Mr. Speaker,
let's have the second supplementary. Please proceed.
Speaker, he says he is satisfied, but he hasn't. Let me just as a matter of by way of completeness. In fact, in relation to this particular project, the Heritage Trust acknowledges the assistance from the Ministry for the Environment, I think in relation to logistical help. But in relation to the comment that he makes, is he really satisfied? Doesn't he think that really more investment needs to be made in relation to this? Because at the end of the day, what he's talking about is that there is scant emphasis placed on the preservation of these old guardians of our freedom, so that it could come to a point where they can't be refurbished at all. I mean, I don't know whether they're in that bad a state. I simply don't know. But shouldn't there be a greater effort on the part of the government to ensure that these artillery postings are properly refurbished sooner rather than later?
Well,
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government has done, if I may say so myself, sterling work in many areas, in the construction of new schools, in the construction of affordable homes and rental homes for the elderly, and we've also invested in the social fabric of our community in many ways. All we have faced, and if I may say so with respect, Mr. Speaker, the work that the Honourable Gentleman has done in the Upper Rock is remarkable, and the work done on the Northern Defences by the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister, really quite spectacular. Every time we do that, we face an accusation that we're spendthrift and we spend too much money. And now the Honourable Gentleman gets up and tells us to spend more money repairing guns. And, well, Mr. Speaker, what we're going to do is we're going to continue to do that which is in our manifesto, which we are able to do, which includes the protection of our heritage and our natural environment, but setting the priorities ourselves, not letting the Honourable Gentleman from opposition to drive the spending priorities. At the moment, I know that he will want to hunt with the hare and run with the, or run with the hare and hunt with the hounds, as usual, and urge us to spend when he thinks he might be garnering one vote or many, and urge us to save when he thinks that he may be garnering one vote or many. We're going to keep our spending priorities fixed on what's in the interest of the people of Gibraltar. This is one part of it, Mr. Speaker, but not the most important.
One final question.
As usual, the Honourable Member, it's in his style. He simply can't help it. He just can't help it. He always needs to make those sort of barbed political comments that we're used to. I'm used to it from him, and I've known him for many years, and that is his modus operandi. That's the way he is, and I don't think he'll ever change. And I'm sure
you need to ask the question with respect. The Honourable David Bacino must ask the question.
Mr. Speaker, yes. In relation to the cost issue, does the Honourable Member have an idea of how much the refurbishment of guns like this would cost? What would be the outlay for the government? Because I think he's shaking his head. And I know it's an unfair question to pounce on him, but the point has been raised in the context of the reply by the Honourable Chief Minister, and I suspect that he's going to be replying rather than the Honourable Member.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I will be replying in my usual style, that to which the Honourable Gentleman has become accustomed, which is to point out the lack of logic in his question and the contradictions. If you urge a government to do something, Mr. Speaker, it usually inevitably involves a cost. If it doesn't involve a cost, usually others in our community will have chosen to do it, or the government itself will have done it earlier. So, of course, unless when he got up he didn't envisage that what he was asking us to do was spend money, this will cost money. Because I've told him this is not something that we have got as a priority, that we have already costed. We don't have an order of cost for it, Mr. Speaker. But the Honourable Gentleman will know that the costs have been published of the works which have been done, either directly by the government or with the support of sponsors in other similar batteries, which are now in very good condition. For example, down by Europa and the O'Hara's gun, Mr. Speaker, which is really quite spectacular. But even then, requires further and additional work. So there's always an order of costs. And what I will not shy away from doing, Mr. Speaker, unless you ask me not to, but not because he does, is point out to the Honourable Gentleman the contradiction in what he does. This, unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, is considered by the Honourable Gentleman to be a barbed political comment. But I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, I with him, as he knows, I have such deep affection for him. I don't want to barb him. I don't want to barb him at all. But I do want to point out to him and to anyone who might fall for his faux charms that actually what lies behind his political position is a morass of contradictions, asking us on the one hand to save money and asking us on the other hand to spend money, even when he doesn't know how much he's asking us to spend. Plus a change, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Roy Clinton, who has a supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will be very brief. Mr. Speaker, I'd like the Honourable Minister, I don't know if he can recall the subject of a 9.2 barrel that was in a scrapyard, and whether he's had any joy in assessing whether it can be saved for posterity. And in fact, the Chief Minister himself called it an impressive piece of military machinery and should not be allowed to rot. This is part of our military history and needs to be displayed appropriately. Although, of course, I hear what the Chief Minister says about cost, but obviously there's no need to let it fall to the scrap merchant.
Mr. Speaker, that there are ways of achieving things which will not necessarily cost the taxpayer inordinate amounts of money, and I am working very hard on achieving a lot at no cost or little cost to the taxpayer. I'm pleased to say that I'm working closely with the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, who are looking at restoring that piece of artillery using sponsorship, and we are now discussing possibly a short list of two possible places in which it could be placed. So that is good news, Mr. Speaker. Thanks to the work of the Heritage Trust and a sponsor who will not yet be made public, because we have still to confirm that, we will be able to restore that at no cost to the taxpayer.
Next question. Question number 20, the Honourable DJ Vecino.
Mr. Speaker, who holds the contracts for the maintenance of Commonwealth Park? When was it put in place? And what has been the total cost of the maintenance under those contractual arrangements since the contract was put in place?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the contractor for the maintenance of Commonwealth Park is Wildlife Gibraltar Limited. This was put in place in July 2014. The cost per financial year has been as follows. 2014-18, £140,641.95. 2015-16, £169,292.90. 2016-17, £170,252.57. 2017-18, £169,498.49. 2018-19, £188,336.41. And for 2019 to 2021, a 24-month year, £418,808.63.
I know this information is publicly available, but can you tell me who the shareholders and directors of Wildlife Gibraltar Limited are?
If it's in the public domain, I'm reminding you, gentlemen, that you can't ask that question.
Speaker, I was just giving it a try and see if the government would be open and transparent in relation to that answer, but I'll spend the...
Unnecessary. Please resume your seat and we move on to the next question.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, did the contract to... was that open out for tender, the contract for the maintenance of Commonwealth Park?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. It was a number of entities were asked at the time.
Mr. Speaker.
We have all of these questions before, all of the references to his wife, all of the references to the cost, all of the references. We've had it all before. Should, we just go to that?
Should the honourable member be called to order? He's speaking to the chamber from a senatory position.
I'm heckling you.
He's heckling me. The honourable member has admitted that member. He's heckling me. The honourable chief minister says that this point has been ventilated in the House before. I'm not sure whether it was ventilated when I wasn't here. It may have been ventilated when I was here last time. Sorry? Possibly.
That the questions were put 6 months, in advance of 6 months ago. That may be the answer that you...
Speaker, it may have been when I was outside of the House during the 15-19 session. But I'd need to check the record. I'll take the honourable member's opposite word for it, and I can always check and revert with your permission to ask further questions once I have had the chance to consider the replies given by the government in relation to this.
Let's move on to the next question.
Question number 21, the Honourable DJ Vecino.
Further to replies given to question 582 of 2020, please provide details of when the contract entered into with Ritech Limited was commenced and what is its duration.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 22, 23 and 24.
Question number 22, the Honourable DJ Vecino.
Further to replies given to question 582 of 2020, please provide the date of the contract entered into with Ritech Limited.
Question number 23, the Honourable DJ Vecino.
Please provide details of the parties who have entered into the contract with Ritech Limited with regards to the operating system of the Upper Rock Nature Reserve.
Question number 22, the Honourable D.J. Vecino. I beg your pardon, question number 24.
Please provide details of the fee arrangements entered into with Ritech Limited in connection with the operating system for the Upper Rock Nature Reserve.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the parties of the contract are Ritech Limited and Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar through the Department of the Environment. The contract was signed on 25th June 2019 and the first payment was made in August 2019. The duration of the contract is for 15 years. The fee arrangement under the agreement is as follows. A, the payment, and I'm quoting from the agreement, the payment from the customer to the supplier in respect of each month shall be the lesser of 1/50% of the amount, the quote, additional revenues, by which sales revenues generated by the system in the month in question exceeds the monthly sales revenues during the previous financial year ending 31st of March 2019, the 2019 revenues, or the lesser of, I repeat, to 10% of the total sales revenues arising in that month. For the purposes of these last two, subparagraphs 1 and 2, sales revenues means the gross revenues from all tickets and commissions received from the sites.
Speaker, it's almost impossible to understand what the Honourable Member has said in the latter part of his reply in relation to the fee arrangements. I will need to consider that with a bit more time. But can he confirm that the fee arrangements are completely and utterly understandable from the reply he has given without necessarily having available to one the entirety of the contract? So, for example, are there matters such as words which are defined in other parts of the contract which would make the excerpt that he's just quoted from the contract completely ununderstandable without having the entirety of the contract available to us?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think I understand what the Honourable Member doesn't understand, so perhaps he could say it again so that perhaps I can understand it.
Speaker, I don't understand it. I do not understand the reply he's given, and all I'm asking him, very simply, is it possible to follow the reply without having the entirety of the contract available to one? Yes. That's it. Is it? Is that the answer? Yes.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, absolutely.
Mr. Speaker, is he able to say whether this particular contract was put out to tender before it was granted? Yes?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. There were a number of entities. This is going back several years. There were a number of entities that made proposals, and this was the one that was selected.
Mr. Speaker, is he able to say whether 36 North Limited has any arrangements from which it benefits as a result of this contract? Is he able to say that at all? The reason why I raise this, Mr. Speaker, because there was, in the answer that the Honourable the Chief Minister gave to the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition back on the 23rd of March, he mentioned some of the contracts that 36 North had entered into, but not necessarily all of them, if I may say so. And I wondered whether there is any contractual arrangements which have been entered into in relation to this, in respect to which basically 36 North Limited itself benefits.
Not by the department, absolutely.
Not by the department in what way? Sorry, I haven't followed his answer.
There is no contractual relationship between the department and the entity that he has mentioned in relation to a contract which is with Ritech Limited.
But is it possible that Ritech Limited has itself entered into an arrangement with 36 North Limited? Mr. Speaker, this is a matter of public interest if that is the case. And surely the government should know if that is the case or not.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is possible that Ritech Limited may have entered into arrangements with 36 North, with TSN, with Hamas, with Syria, with anyone else, Mr. Speaker. How do we know? No, Mr. Speaker, what a ridiculous question, if the Honourable Gentleman may permit me to ask. The Honourable Gentleman has asked a question to which the only potential answer is yes. If the Honourable Gentleman says, is it possible that Ritech Media have entered into arrangements with 36 North, the answer can only be yes, but it can only be yes in the context of the fact that Ritech Media may also have entered into arrangements with Tristan Indonesia, which the Honourable Gentleman is a member, and we would not know, but he might. that they might have entered into arrangements with, I don't want to mention any other company in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, that's why I mentioned companies outside, with the British Broadcasting Corporation, for all we know. And if they don't require our consent under the contract for those arrangements, which might be for the disposal of rubbish, for the disposal of their data, or for whatever, how could we know? And how can I legitimately permit anyone to give an answer to this House which would be wrong? But the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, has asked a question which is so open-ended that it is frankly not a question that I think is designed to elucidate any genuine information. If the Honourable Gentleman knows something that we obviously don't, he should share it with us so that we, as the representatives of the public, can have that information, because that would be in the public interest and in our interest too. Speaker,
I this will be the final. The Honourable Dame will say the final question.
Yes. Speaker, I'm told that there is an arrangement between Right Tech Limited and 36 North Limited. Of course, this is the company that the Honourable Member has openly said in this House he is, by virtue of the fact that he is a sabbatical partner of Hassan's, a beneficiary as to 33%. So, yeah, and I'm not going to ask him in terms of his personal capacity, because that's a matter which is of his personal capacity, although it is a matter of public interest, because at the end of the day, he's the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, and a member of his, well, no longer a member of his cabinet, but a backbencher on the government side is also a beneficiary of that. So can I ask him whether he knows whether Right Tech Limited has entered into contractual arrangements with 36 North in circumstances where his official reply is that it is within the realms of possibilities that Right Tech Limited has entered into contractual arrangements with 36 North Limited?
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the Honourable Gentleman in my personal capacity, in my professional capacity as a lawyer, and in my political capacity as the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, all three together. I do not know at all about any arrangements entered into between Right Tech Media and 36 North. But the Honourable Gentleman has been very happy to recite all those people who have a potential interest in 36 North sitting on this side, but he hasn't referred to the Honourable Gentleman sitting to his left, who is also a partner of Hassan's. And he hasn't referred to the fact that he and the Leader of the Opposition work with the wife directly of one of the partners or one of the owners of 36 North, Mr. Speaker. So if the public interest is going to be elucidated, let's put everything under the microscope of the public interest. We on this side of the House have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of any arrangements entered into between 36 North and this company, Right Tech Media. If the Honourable Gentleman says that there are such arrangements, he might disclose them to us. We will now, as a result of this questioning, ask 36 North in writing whether there are any such arrangements, Mr. Speaker. That is the position which will help elucidate to the whole of the public, to the whole of the public, the reality of the situation. And then, Mr. Speaker, we will have before all of the public all of the information. Now, Mr. Speaker, given that I have told him that I am not aware of those arrangements, I don't know whether he is going to impute bad faith or misfeasance to me. If he is, I put it to him that he needs to come up with specific information, because the Honourable Gentleman likes to throw the stone and hide the hand. He likes to pretend that he's a gentleman, Mr. Speaker, but then he behaves like a scoundrel.
That word is unparliamentary. Hold on. Please resume the seat. I think that word, the use of the word is unparliamentary. I don't accept that.
Mr. Speaker, I withdraw the word scoundrel. I'd rather just call him a fool.
Mr. Speaker, is the word the fool? The point I was going to make was, is that parliamentary?
I have to agree with the Honourable Dame Bazino. It's also unparliamentary, not at the level of scoundrel, but it is unparliamentary. So we now move on to the next question.
Question number 25, the Honourable DJ Bazino.
But this would be a tamer question, Mr. Speaker. What is the restoration and any associated ongoing costs of the Nun's Well to the government, and which company was awarded the contract to carry out the restoration works?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 26 and 27.
Question number 26, the Honourable DJ Vosino.
What is the refurbishment and any associated ongoing costs of the Central Hall to the government, and please confirm the details of the company involved in the refurbishment?
Question number 27, the Honourable K.S. Opadri.
Mr. Speaker, not the
KA as a party, but Mr. Speaker, I've been asked to ask this question on behalf of the Leader of the Opposition. What has been the cost to date of the works towards the creation of the green area by Midtown?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of the restoration of Nuns Well was £77,386.15, carried out during the financial years 1819 and 1921. The contractors were GJBS and Progressive Construction and Wastage Limited, the latter carrying out the emptying of the accumulated sludge. In answer to question 26, the cost of refurbishment and heritage restoration of the Central Hall was £146,478.50. The contractor was Seoul Construction Limited. The refurbishment included the work on the main ballroom, exposing original stonework on the heritage walls, and exposing the ceiling and iron supports, bringing it back to its original state and doing justice to its former use as a church. The work also included the refurbishment and paving of the rear exterior areas, including fire escapes, as requested by GFRS, and the refurbishment of the entrance lobby. The ongoing costs of the hall are the recurring monthly electricity, water and cleaning expenses amounting to approximately £6,300 annually. The cost to date of the works at the Midtown Park is £3,769,440.73. That's it, Mr. Speaker.
So in relation to both of my questions, can he state whether those contracts also went out to tender at all? And if I may say, in relation to the Nuns Well question, did he say what the ongoing costs were?
Mr. Speaker, there were a minimum of three quotes for the work in process. For the works that had to be carried out. I believe that in the case of Wastage Limited, it may be that they were the only one who were able to do it because of the specialised work in sludge removal. Mr. Speaker, I haven't given the ongoing cost of Nuns Well because they are minimal. It's the electricity. It hasn't been ongoing for long enough. We've only recently opened it, and the lights are switched off for most of the time. It's only switched on when there are organised tours. So minimal, negligible ongoing costs for Nuns Well.
So the tender question also was also made in relation to the Central Hall. Did he answer that?
Mr. Speaker, the work for Central Hall was carried out for the Ministry of Culture by Gibraltar Cultural Services, and they sought three quotes as well.
And in relation to the Central Hall, I think the government press release talked about this being the first phase. And I'm not sure whether he's answered the point, because I haven't asked it, but in relation to his replies, whether he's shed any light as to whether there's going to be a second or indeed third phase, and when those are going to happen, and when he expects the whole refurbishment to be complete.
The second phase, Mr. Speaker, is the re-landscaping of the garden area to the east so that it could be used for receptions and so on. It's in the process of being costed and so on, and we'll see whether we decide to undertake it or not.
If I may, Mr. Speaker, so in relation to the building itself, that's done and dusted, we're there.
Mr. Speaker, with the exception of the stained glass windows, which are currently being manufactured.
Does the Honourable Phillips?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, if I may, just one
question. Arising from the Nuns Well question, before we get on to Mr. Azapardi's question. Mr. Speaker, what measures have the government taken in relation to the stagnant water at Nuns Well? Obviously, it was closed due to mosquitoes, as far as I understand, but what measures have the government taken?
Mr. Speaker, the water in Nuns Well is not stagnant. It is absolutely clear. I was there just a couple of days ago, the end of last week, with His Excellency the Governor, and it's not stagnant. There is no sign of mosquitoes. It is being monitored, and if it were to become a problem, then it would be tackled. There are several ways, Mr. Speaker, tackling, but again, Mr. Speaker, I say this is not a logical extension of the question.
Let's move on to a supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, if I may, just as a point of order, and in order to ensure that the record of Hansard is as accurate as possible, I'm not sure whether there may have been an error in the reply given by the Honourable Member in relation to the Commonwealth Park question. He gave a figure, the first figure he gave, if I'm of assistance to him, I think was 140,641. And did he say that, did he give the years as 2014 to 2018? Is that correct? Or is it meant to read 2015? Because I may have heard incorrectly, but he may have said it, and then it will remain as part of the record of the House on an incorrect and erroneous basis.
Speaker, 14-15, I may have misread it, but I don't think I did. 15.
You're going, yeah. Supplementaries on the Honourable Leader's Vision's question. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the answer as to the cost to date of the works on the creation of the green area by Midtown. And obviously, many members of the public may have choked on their calendita when they heard that the cost was £3 million in relation to that green area. I would ask whether the government minister has a breakdown insofar as the lift, the green areas, the paving slabs, the particular Child's Park and the continuing trees that are planted there. I wonder whether the government had any breakdown of that.
Mr. Speaker, not broken down as the Honourable Member has asked, but I can tell him, remember that this was built on the site of a power station, and the complexities of converting that into a park where trees will grow and green grass will thrive is tremendous. The removal, the breaking out and removal of the old power station engine beds in itself cost £250,000. The removal and exportation of contaminated material from the ground, which was essential, was about £390,000. So those are two elements of the breakdown that I have. It was a complex project. I think that the results are there for all to see. I recall when members opposite were very critical of our work on Commonwealth Park. In fact, they almost mocked the very idea of it. I'm glad to have heard that the Honourable Mr. Mocino jogged through it today. If the Honourable Members haven't been there, I recommend it. It is an extraordinary place to visit in Gibraltar. It is used by thousands on an annual basis, and the Midtown Park will have that same use and more.
That cost, I would assume, also that cost also includes the removal of the turf that was initially laid to be replaced at Alameda, right? Or not?
Mr. Speaker, that cost likely includes it, but I have already explained, Mr. Speaker, that that was in order to have not left during the COVID period a dust bowl which would have had repercussions throughout the area. So lawn was laid in order to contain it, because it wasn't the proper lawn, which couldn't come over because it had to come from UK, and we were in the middle of the COVID pandemic.
Right, next question.
Question number 28, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the legal position of the use of electric scooters in Gibraltar?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, the government will shortly be publishing legislation in this regard.
Uh, Mr. Speaker, whilst I'm grateful that the Minister now has confirmed post the consultation process, I assume, and the questions have been asked on this, I did ask if he could set out what the legal position of the use of electric scooters was, not that he was bringing legislation. I just want, many members of the public have been quite concerned at some of the sights that we've seen on our roads. I don't need to recite them to this House, but it's obvious, Mr. Speaker. And that's why I've been asked to ask the government what they consider the legal position to be in relation to these vehicles. That is exactly the question I've asked, and I haven't had an answer to it.
So, Speaker, as I said, we're bringing legislation to make this, to make sure that these e-scooters can be used lawfully. So, that is what I mean by that we'll be bringing legislation very soon.
So, Mr. Speaker, the logical corollary of that, which is something that you must read to, the use of them currently is unlawful, is that correct?
I wouldn't agree with you that it's really unlawful, because they're being used. There is no sort of fixed legislation on how they can be used, and that is imminent. We'll be bringing that to the House within the next month or so.
Mr. Speaker, just one additional question. The legislation that the government intends, does that also require users of these e-scooters to be insured for their use?
That has been one of the difficulties that we've encountered in whether the insurance companies want to insure these e-scooters. But we're getting there, and I think we'll be in a position to have insurance for these e-scooters.
Next question. Question number 29, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state whether or not they intend to equalise or standardise parking rental rates in all government estates?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, government estates have different parking facilities depending on location and space available. If the Honourable Member advises me as to which government estate he's alluding to, I'm happy to look into it and revert.
Next question. Question number 30, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm that it intends to clamp down on the practice of non-electric cars parking in bays which are designed for electric charging at Midtown Car Park?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, the designated electric charging points bays at Midtown Car Park are being monitored remotely by CCTV and by manned security patrols on a 24-hour basis. Any non-electric vehicles which park within these bays are immediately towed away.
Next question. Question number 31, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state that they are in talks with the Bassadoni Group about taking over the MOT testing function from the Transport Ministry?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Next question. Question number 32, the Honourable DJ Vosino.
Can the Minister for Tourism state when it is expected that the identity of the CEO of the GTB will be announced to include his salary and any other perks?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, when we are ready to do so.
Does he have an idea as to when that occasion will arise?
Mr. Speaker, I don't feel that I need to give him a blow-by-blow account of this process. So,
that he doesn't believe we should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. So when we're ready, we'll make the announcement.
Is he able to say, Mr. Speaker, now that the advert, I think, appeared, and I think the deadline for the making applications has now gone? Is he able to now say how much the CEO is expected to earn by way of financial
gain and in relation to his salary and any other associated perks. He will recall that I asked this question at the last session of the House on the 17th of March. I got the answer here, where when I probed him in relation to this, he says that he clearly wasn't able to provide or wasn't willing to provide me with the answer. And he said, I do not see why he cannot wait for a couple of weeks, for 2 or 3 weeks, when he will see the advert and we will be in a position to discuss. The advert was published, and I don't have it with me. I saw it in the Gibraltar Chronicle, but I think it said something along the lines of competitive. It didn't give any details as to what his salary would be.
I'm not prepared to give any further information on the salary, but what I will say is that it will be commensurate to the person's experience and needs to be negotiated.
I was going to ask in relation to that, in terms of probing further in relation to that. It's the same answer he gave me in the last session, on the last occasion that I asked him in this House on the 17th of March. Does he not agree with me that it shouldn't be really commensurate with the experience of the successful applicant? It should be commensurate with what he is expected to do, which, as he has said, I think in his first statement when he announced his initiative in relation to this issue, is quite a long list. It's quite a wide berth that this individual will be expected to discharge in terms of responsibility. So shouldn't it be commensurate with that rather than with the experience of the successful individual?
Mr. Speaker, it seems that he's arguing that we should pay this person more. Look, like I said, I mean, the application process has closed, so we'll be looking at the applicants, and like I said, we'll be making an announcement soon.
Next question. Next question, please. Question number 33, the Honourable DJ Vosino.
Mr. Speaker, this question relates to the green-lighted destination issue. Yes, I'm happy to state that for the record. The Honourable Member did call me and said whether perhaps when I filed the question, it was still relevant in the sense that we didn't have that information. I think when he called me, the information may have been out in terms of the UK government's decision. I decided to leave it on the order paper because I thought there were interesting supplementaries which could be asked. But I think that may now go by the wayside as a result of the Honourable the Chief Minister's statement earlier today. So I'm happy to withdraw that statement unless the Minister is really keen to provide his response to it.
Next question. Next question, please. Question number 34, the Honourable DJ Vosino.
Please provide an update as to whether Volotea has obtained the required permits to allow it to operate the announced flight to Gibraltar, obviously from Bilbao.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, I presume the question should have read, can the government or indeed the Minister for Tourism please provide an update? In any case, Mr. Speaker, I am not in a position to provide an update on this matter.
Speaker, can I ask him, I'm not going to take lessons from the Honourable Member as to how I should pose the questions. I pose the questions as I deem fit. I file them with the House. And if there's something untoward with them, no doubt I'll receive a call from the parliamentary staff or indeed from yourself, Mr. Speaker. But, I've asked similar questions in the same vein of his honourable colleague in Cabinet, and he hasn't raised any objection. But, can I just ask him whether he has made any inquiries as to progress in relation to this and what his current estimation is as to whether this is likely to happen, and if so, when?
Mr. Speaker, he's right that I can't give him lessons on asking questions because I've never asked questions before, as I've never lost an election before. So now moving on to...
Mr. Speaker, could you resume the seat? Mr. Speaker, what is What is your point of order?
The Honourable Member, in his usual style, but of course he talks vacuously, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. The Honourable Member, stood for election. No, it's not true. The Honourable Member stood for election, I think it was in the year 2000, and he didn't get a seat. So, Mr. Speaker, he's wrong in what he said. He lost that election. He did not get a seat in Parliament. So, therefore, he is wrong and incorrect.
Can the Honourable Minister answer the question, please?
I think his question was that he wanted to know whether there's going to be another update. No? Well, look, Mr. Speaker, I don't know when there will be an update with Voltaire. But let me tell him, Mr. Speaker, I've told the member opposite that each time he makes these comments, he damages Gibraltar's chances of opening new routes. Yeah. And of attracting new airlines from the Schengen zone. But he continues, Mr. Speaker, as if he's hell-bent on destroying the government's attempts in this field. Let me tell him.
I don't think it's right that you should... You will have an opportunity to question in supplementary.
Let me tell him that his defeatist... A negative attitude will not stop me from continuing my hard work on promoting Gibraltar Airport and bringing unprecedented connectivity to it. Our people can see through his pointless and childish press releases. While we work round the clock to attract new business, new opportunities, and revitalize our economy, he continues playing politics at Gibraltar's expense, not realizing the disservice that he does to our homeland and the manner in which it prejudices the government's position. He obviously doesn't care whether we succeed or not, as long as he has his relevance for one day in the press. However, since they seem to want to carry on talking about air services, may I remind the Honourable Member opposite, the Parliament, and indeed all those watching and listening, that this government has ensured that this summer more airlines will be operating to Gibraltar, to more destinations than ever before. Heathrow, Gatwick, Luton, London City, Manchester, Bristol, Southampton, Birmingham, Edinburgh, and Mr. Speaker, there's more to come. We have shown vision and ambition, something that the opposition clearly don't have and did not have when they were in government. We will keep on disappointing him by being even more ambitious with our airport network expansion plans. Our tourism sector and our business sector expect this of us. I'm continuously congratulated for the excellent work we are doing, and for as long as I'm Minister for Tourism, I will never adopt his pessimistic and detractive attitude. Instead of being positive for Gibraltar in these difficult times, he is obviously envious of our success. That is so typical of him and his colleagues, who at every opportunity criticize the government without thinking of what they actually say and the damage they do. Please take a seat.
The Honourable Minister, please resume his seat. Now, the point of order is absolutely right. You are tending to go a bit overboard in your explanation, and you're making a statement which is supposedly to be concise. I know you want to state what the position is, what the government position is, but you must make it rather more concise. Right, so if you could wrap up very quickly.
Speaker, they complain when we don't give them answers, and when they get a full answer, they also complain. They don't like to...
Anyway...
Well, like I said, it is so typical of him and his colleagues, who at every opportunity criticize the government without thinking of what they actually say and the damage they do. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Hold on, just a second. The Honourable Damian Mussina wishes to ask the supplementary?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, Mr. Speaker, look, what an immature, pathetic reply we've just been treated to in this House. But it's typical of him. No, Mr. Speaker, I will be allowed to respond to some of the points that he's making. Mr. Speaker, I'll ask the question. I've been called to order by yourself, or I've been called to order by the Chief Minister, the Leader of the House, the Mr. Everything. Power has gone to his head, and it is so obvious at every session of this House. The sooner he loses it, the better for him, and the better for our society, quite frankly.
Let us have a question.
It was a very simple one, and it dealt with whether he has made any inquiries. I don't think he's answered that question, because he has been so hell-bent in regurgitating and rehashing the debate we've already had in the airwaves, and the debates we've already had by virtue of press releases, right, that he's forgotten to answer the question I asked. But let me ask him another question.
You repeat the question or answer another question.
I'll ask another question, Mr. Speaker. Should he not be standing in this House today and acknowledging the error of his ways, and therefore apologizing to the people of Gibraltar for having led them down the garden path by telling them that we had a new airline, Volotea, coming to Gibraltar and going to Bilbao, when in fact he hadn't done the most basic, the most obvious of due diligence by asking Volotea, before he participated quite freely in the announcement, of his great announcement, that there would be a new airline and a new air route to Bilbao, that they didn't have the basic permits and permissions from the relevant authorities. He should be apologising. And if we had a bigger parliament, Mr. Speaker, he should be resigning and going to the back benches. That's what he should be doing. Does he not agree with me?
Can the Honourable Damon Seen resume his seat?
Mr. Speaker, the government does not agree with the Honourable Mr. Busina, both in relation to my head or to the position of the Honourable Minister for Tourism. The government, in fact, considers that the Honourable Minister for Tourism is doing a magnificent job. And I'll tell the Honourable Gentleman why. I'll tell the Honourable Gentleman why. That is not just the position of the government, Mr. Speaker. That is the objectively verifiable situation. Because if we measure ministers for tourism against the routes available from Gibraltar Airport, then the Honourable the Minister for Tourism, and the Honourable Gentleman was asking about routes from Gibraltar Airport, is able to be credited with a situation where he has brought more flights to more destinations than just about any other minister for tourism, including those which have previously served in my government, and indeed certainly more than ever served in governments of the initials of the party that the Honourable Gentleman craves to represent, even though he has failed to lead it, both when he has been offered an opportunity of an open goal, or indeed when he has tried in a leadership election to succeed. I still have much to say, Mr. Speaker.
We are being controlled on this side of the House in terms of the amount of questions that we're asking, the manner of questions.
Sorry, what are you suggesting?
Mr. Speaker, all I'm saying is that they should be subject to some control as well. The reply that he has given is wholly irrelevant to the point I've raised. What's my leadership ambitions got to do with Voltaire and Bilbao? Why does he have to bring it on each occasion, this particular issue? It is wholly and utterly irrelevant. And actually, to be honest, Mr. Speaker, I want him to carry on doing it. I want him to carry on doing it because it's increasingly becoming a joke and people are seeing through him. That is my point of order. And that should be curtailed and controlled.
Right.
If I might, because I was coming on to the Voltaire issue, which the Honourable Gentleman wants to know about. Well, yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker, because I was going to say that I know that the Honourable Gentleman must have been hankering after the Voltaire flight, because he stands more chance of being Lendakari than he does of being Chief Minister, if he carries on like he's going. Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman did in relation to Voltaire, was exactly the same thing that he does in relation to every airline that tells them that they're going to fly to Gibraltar, which is ask them whether they have dealt with all of the issues that they need to deal with, ensure, Mr. Speaker, that before the government says anything, they've addressed that. But do you think that the Honourable the Minister for Tourism rang the Civil Aviation Authority in London to ask them whether British Airways had permission to fly to City, when they told us that they wanted to fly to City? Or that when Eastern decide that they're going to fly from Southampton to Birmingham, the first thing that we do is phone the Civil Aviation Authority to ask them that in London? Or when Wizz tell us that they're going to fly, or that Edinburgh is going to be added by EasyJet, we call the Civil Aviation to do that, Aviation Authority to check that they can? Or that indeed any GSD minister ever did that when they were advised that there was an opportunity that an airline would be flying a route? Of course not, Mr. Speaker. What we do is we refer the companies to the Gibraltar situation, and we permit them to deal with the issues that they have to deal with in the other nations where they may be flying from. That's, of course, what would happen. But there is another issue in relation to Volotea that the Honourable Gentleman needs to think about, Mr. Speaker. And with all of the bluster, and with all of the desire to get up, and with now, Mr. Speaker, the abuse of the point of order, which is simply now being used as a device by Honourable Members opposite, to press a button and say, I don't like what is being said, which is not what a point of order is. A point of order is a very specific reference to the rules of the House which are being broken. What the Honourable Gentleman does not want to hear, or perhaps has not even thought of, is that there were more things in play in relation to the Voltaire filing. It was the first route potentially from Spain. So, Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Gentleman think that when a Spanish airline approaches the government of Gibraltar and says, we are ready to fly a route to Gibraltar Airport from Spain, that the first thing the government of Gibraltar should say is, no, don't do it, or have you phoned Exteriores, or gentlemen, have you checked with the Spanish state that you can fly? Or we should say, well, gentlemen, we think this is very good. You, our civil aviation authorities in Gibraltar will very much welcome you. Or does the Honourable Gentleman not think that perhaps, and I'm not saying that this would be the case, it would be a very interesting way of testing whether those who might be negotiating with the government are going to agree that a flight should happen or not happen? And shouldn't that sort of tactical consideration, which is to the benefit of Gibraltar, be something that Honourable Members might have worked out for themselves and might not require, if it had been the case, explicit reference across the floor of the House? Or perhaps, Mr. Speaker, it's just that the Honourable Gentleman now will be so embarrassed that he didn't realise that that was one of the potential things going on in the background, that he will now understand why the Honourable Gentleman was telling him, my Honourable colleague was telling him, that perhaps he needs to think a little bit more before he gets up and says things which might not be to the benefit of Gibraltar, if he still cares more about Gibraltar than any other patria.
Right. Next question.
Mr. Speaker, may I? On this issue. I've always been here, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, is the Chief Minister suggesting that the cataclysmic failure of presentation of the Voltaire announcement of the route was actually planned and staged and in some sort of great strategic ploy was deliberately arranged by the government? Is that what he's suggesting? Is that what he's suggesting in his last answer? We certainly think that if that is the that is one of the questions, but I've got a second question. So. Well, I won't ask more questions. I bundle them up because, in the interest of concision, the government can bundle up answers, but not questions, surely. I am happy to ask one question at a time, Mr. Speaker. I was all mindful of previous advice and guidance from the chair that wanted us to move quickly, and it's very difficult on this side to move quickly when we then get extended answers shooting in different directions. But I'll keep it to that question. Is the Chief Minister suggesting that the cataclysmic failure is somehow a master ploy of the government to expose this great strategy of attracting routes to Gibraltar, but getting the airline that has announced the route to then pull the ticket sale because it was, unfortunately, not one that was announced with permission?
Mr. Speaker, I'm quite happy to tell the other more likely candidate for Lehendakari than Chief Minister that there has been no cataclysmic failure, and that therefore the answer is that the premise on which his question is based is entirely wrong.
You have a second supplementary. Next question.
Question number 60, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state who has acquired the Rook site and at what price?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question number 61.
Question number 61, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, in the event that a company or group of companies has acquired a lease over the Rook site, can the government state the names of the ultimate beneficial owners of that company or group of companies?
Answer, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government continues in discussion with two entities in respect of the Rook site. Therefore, nobody has acquired the site and nobody has acquired a lease over it.
In light of that, when does the government, Mr. Speaker, expect to make an announcement in relation to the company or group of companies being successful?
Mr. Speaker, following advice given by our members in the past, the government will make the announcement when the agreement has been concluded. So at the moment, negotiations are ongoing.
And can I just ask on that, is it that the scope of the discussions with the preferred entity, does it entail all the components that were publicly explained at the 2019 election in their manifesto that would be in that site?
I can confirm to you, remember, that is the intention, Mr. Speaker, and part of the discussion.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House should now adjourn to Wednesday at 3:30 p.m.
I now propose a question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Wednesday, the 19th of May at 3:30 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Wednesday, the 19th of May at 3:30 p.m. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Passed. The House will now adjourn to Wednesday, the 19th of May at 3:30 p.m.